groceries and housing, and she'll also pledge tonight to listen to people who disagree with her.
Well, Trump himself was out there today at that location, right? Trying to get ahead of Harris's remarks. I'm curious, what did he have to say?
Well, he wasn't at that location. He was doing a different event, and he did not talk about January 6th directly. Instead, you know, he focused on his main campaign issue, which is immigration. And he blamed Harris for the problems with border security and accused her of running a, quote, campaign of hate. You know, Trump is dealing with backlash after his own event recently where he gave his closing arguments, and a comedian at that event made disparaging comments about Puerto Rico and more broadly Latinos. Trump did not address that today at his event. His campaign has been trying to appeal more to Latino voters. And tonight, around the same time that Harris will be speaking, the former president is scheduled to give remarks of his own in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I do want to point out that is a former steel town where a majority of the population is Latino.
That is NPR's Asma Khalid. Thank you so much, Asma.
Good to speak with you.
Who preserves what happens on the internet? Well, one answer can be found in an old church in San Francisco, which is home to the Internet Archive. That's a nonprofit with a bigger digital collection than the Library of Congress. The archive holds a record of billions of web pages on its servers. This month, it was attacked by hackers. It was offline for days, prompting a question, what would get lost if the Internet Archive is no more? Brewster Kahle is the founder of Internet Archive, and he's on the line now from San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mary Louise.
So I just checked. Your site looks like it's up and running. It's online. Is everything back and fully restored?
It's not fully restored, but the basic services of archive.org and the Wayback Machine, yes, our library is back, which is
the Wayback Machine, really just to inject, this is the archival service for your website.
Yes, yes. That's where we collect web pages by working with 1,300 libraries, and then we make a free service, to make it so you could see the web as it was.
So can you just describe what these last couple of weeks have looked like for you as you've tried to get the website back online and keep it up and running?
Oh, it's been so hard. Basically, we needed to upgrade our security significantly because basically somebody was able to deface our website. There's no damage to the data, which is great, but they did get our usernames and email addresses of patrons of the Internet Archive. So people's passwords continued to be safe because they were all encrypted. But the list of email addresses doesn't help the spam problem out there.
Yeah. So why would hackers target you?
We don't know, but we're not the only ones. So, yes, we were targeted with cyber attacks, but also Calgary Public Library got hit, and they're still offline. Seattle Public Library System was attacked, and they're mostly back up. Toronto Public Library, and the big one was British Library, was attacked a year ago, and still some of their services aren't back up.
There's no ransom that's been demanded, nothing like that.
No, there hasn't been that. It's mostly been embarrassing. So we have gotten the message, and we're addressing putting in more and better firewalls and code sanitization to go and make sure that the services stay up as people are expecting.
Yeah. There's obviously a rich irony here for a site dedicated to preserving activity on the internet potentially being wiped off the internet. What would be lost if a cyber attack had actually succeeded at damaging your site permanently?
Well, if the Internet Archive were to go away, it has unique collections of the World Wide Web and also books, music, video, television, for decades of television. It's a full-fledged library. So the idea of losing the Internet Archive is not just the web collection, but it would be a whole lot more.
What you're describing, Mr. Kahle, is such a huge responsibility, protecting all of this information. Are you confident you can do it?
We'll do everything we can. It's part of the job. We have preservation and access as sort of tattooed into our souls. So preservation, to go and make sure that the information that we've collected stays, and then we can we make it as accessible as possible? We first wanted to make sure that our preservation function was in good shape, which we did, and then we worked very hard to try to get the access back up. But we're just seeing attacks on libraries from many different angles, and this is just another one.
That is Brewster Kahle, digital librarian and founder of the Internet Archive. Thank you.
Thank you.
The deadliest Israeli airstrike in weeks happened in northern Gaza overnight. More than 70 Palestinians were killed, at least 25 of whom were children. And more are missing, according to the Ministry of Health. It comes as Israel's parliament voted to ban the main UN agency for aid in Gaza. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, and a warning, this story describes graphic scenes of war.
Freelance photojournalist Islam Ahmed was just two streets away when an Israeli airstrike hit a five-story building full of displaced Palestinian families in the northern neighborhood of Beit Lehia. He hurried to the scene. I saw human parts and dead bodies in the streets, Ahmed told NPR in a voice note. Ahmed says he also saw bodies trapped under the rubble and that he and other civilians tried to pull them out, but he couldn't reach them because the rubble was too heavy and they didn't have tools. Last week, the Israeli military demanded the Gaza civil defense teams leave the area, meaning the usual first responders were not there. We used our bare hands, Ahmed says. These were not the hands of paramedics or well-trained people, he says. It was the hands of us, their neighbors. Northern Gaza, and specifically Beit Lehia, has been besieged by the Israeli military for weeks. No ambulances or vehicles could get in or out. So people were carrying the wounded to the nearest hospital on their backs or using donkey carts, hospital officials told NPR. But Israeli forces raided that hospital over the weekend, saying that Hamas was operating from it. They destroyed much of it and detained many of the staff. Hospital officials say their ability to treat the wounded is limited and the morgue is not functioning. The dead from today's strike were buried in the streets. The Israeli military did not give a reason for the strike, but said it was, quote, looking into the incident. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, Israel's parliament passed legislation banning operations for UNRWA, the United Nations' main aid agency for Palestinians. Israel says the agency has ties to Hamas, and some staffers took part in the October attack last year that sparked this current war. But many say UNRWA is essential for life-saving operations on the ground in Gaza. Here's Kate Phillips-Barrasso from the aid group Mercy Corps.
This could potentially be a final knockout blow to the humanitarian response, certainly in Gaza,
where humanitarian needs are dire. And Phillips-Barrasso says UNRWA can't simply be replaced. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, lots of frequencies all around the state. We're always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Topeka's Noto Arts and Entertainment District, featuring a celebration of souls, Day of the Dead in southern Mexico, exploring the Dia de los Muertos holiday, traditions and origins, now till December 14th. Information at explorenoto.org.
Stay tuned. Coming up in our next half hour, researchers have discovered a Mayan settlement thought to be more than 1,000 years old, hidden deep in the jungle in the Yucatan Peninsula. We'll tell you more about it also in the next 30 minutes. State of Kansas has more than 4,000 wind turbines, and on a day like today, that seems like a great idea. The state now gets almost half of its energy from wind power, and that is, in fact, good news, but it might not be as good a news as you think.
In spite of all the additional renewable energy production in Kansas and across the country, fossil fuel consumption nationwide hasn't really gone down all that much.
Coming up on KPR, our commentator Rex Buchanan talks about renewable energy and the changing landscape of Kansas, all straight ahead here on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Z's Divine Espresso, offering organic coffees via drive-through windows and inside at 1800 East 23rd Street and 2351 West 31st in Lawrence. CoffeeInLawrence.com.
Classical music coming your way on your KPR1 stations tonight, following All Things Considered from 7 to 9 p.m. Destiny is your host. The ghosts coming out to play tonight, ghosts including the Grey Lady, the Dog of Godley, the Bank of England Clerk, the Girl in the Tower, and more. Join us tonight, 7 to 9 p.m.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 4 years ago, President Biden won Pennsylvania by less than 2 percentage points. Included in his winning coalition were young voters who sided with him by a 27-point margin. Well, this year, Vice President Harris's campaign is trying to nail down those voters again, heading to both the blue cities and suburbs and small towns and rural areas that are places for former President Trump handily won. NPR's Elena Moore takes us to a small town an hour outside Pittsburgh to hear from young students about how they see their voting power.
Indiana, Pennsylvania has some big titles. Some call it the Christmas tree capital of the world, and it just so happens to be the birthplace of actor Jimmy Stewart. I'm standing in front of a statue of him outside the town courthouse. But it's not quite Christmas time yet. It is almost November, and nearby at the Indiana University of Pennsylvania's campus, some locals want to give this place another title.
The road to the White House goes through Indiana County, Pennsylvania.
Local Democratic Party Chair Lynn Alvine is watching as student organizers set up for a Get Out the Vote rally. And while this campus may be part of a tiny blue dot, it lives within a red county that went for Trump last time by 37 points. But Alvine understands that. The goal is to narrow the margins.
Our motto is lose by less. We don't imagine that we can win the vote for Harris in Indiana County, but we can bring out enough Democratic votes.
I think we bring the energy to counties like this.
IUP student Andrew Muth runs the school's College Democrats. As somebody from a rural area less than an hour away, he knows why voters here feel left behind. But he says Harris has a message that can connect with locals.
We want you to be able to build a family. We want you to be able to afford your groceries. We want you to be able to afford housing.
Local Republicans, though, aren't worried about the margins, even with the student vote.
You know, a lot of those students are not students from Indiana County. They're outsiders.
That's 24-year-old Hunter Overdorf. He's with the local GOP, and he grew up here. Still, the Harris campaign is working hard in rural areas of Pennsylvania. They have 50 offices in the state coordinated with the Democratic Party, 16 of those in counties that Trump won by double digits in 2020. Those past margins are why the Trump campaign isn't worried.
Reaching out to voters and canvassing them is important, but that only works when you have a winning candidate and a winning message.
That's Kush Desai, the Pennsylvania Communications Director for the Trump campaign.
The issues that we're running on, if anything, have a greater salience in rural Pennsylvania and rural America writ large.
Those issues, the economy and immigration. At a coffee shop on IUP's campus, those are the topics shaping 22-year-old grad student Keely McElveen's vote.
I'm going to vote for Trump and Vance. It's kind of a philosophy of voting for the lesser of two evils amongst the parties.
She's from the county over and commutes to school, so things like gas prices are a concern. And to her, Harris hasn't acknowledged the mistakes of the last 4 years and how she'll be different.
That's kind of pulled me away from her in a sense. I will say Trump could be a better communicator just because he's very loud, which polarizes our people. However, he is very clear on what he stands for. That speaks volumes.
Back at the rally, other students continue to side with Harris, in large part over social issues, which are key to her campaign's message.
I'm always an advocate for someone having their own right to their body and who they love and what medical decisions they should make.
20-year-old Samaya Settles is from a town outside Pittsburgh, but she plans to vote on campus. She was much more excited to have Harris as the Democratic nominee than President Biden, and thinks that energy remains for other young people.
I would say I still feel that, and I think it is because of her age. She really does know how to connect with the young people. She just feels like she is us.
And in just 1 week, we'll see how many other young people feel the same. Elena Moore, NPR News, Indiana, Pennsylvania.
So if you or your kid has a cough that's been lingering, you may want to listen closely to this next story. The CDC says cases of a type of walking pneumonia are surging across the U.S., especially among young kids. NPR health correspondent Maria Godoy has more.
Dr. Preeti Sharma is a pediatric pulmonologist at UT Southwestern and Children's Health in Dallas. She's also a mom of two. At the end of May, her 12-year-old daughter came home from school with what looked like a typical summer cold.
She had a runny nose, some sneezing, a little bit of sore throat, and a little bit of kind of feeling fatigued, lower appetite.
And then the cough started.
We just kind of watched it progress until she had this very lingering, deep, disruptive cough.
That cough is what tipped Sharma off that her daughter had mycoplasma pneumonia. It's caused by a bacterial infection. The CDC says cases began rising across the U.S. in the spring and summer, and that surge has continued into fall. Sharma says in Dallas, they saw a big spike after kids went back to school.
Kids are spreading it to one another in schools, and they are likely bringing it home to their parents and families as well.
This pneumonia usually manifests with upper respiratory symptoms, though some kids can also develop red eyes or rashes. Dr. Kayla Board is with Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C., which has seen a tenfold increase in cases this year. He says the good news is many cases tend to be mild, hence the term walking pneumonia.
Folks historically may have been going to school, going to work, assumed they just had a kind of mild cold virus, and in fact had mycoplasma pneumonia.
New York City has also seen a jump in cases. Dr. Adam Ratner is an infectious disease specialist at NYU and Hassenfeld Children's Hospital. He says mycoplasma pneumonia is usually seen in kids ages 5 to 17.
That has changed in the last year with this current spike.
He says while the infection is still more common in these older kids,
we're seeing more cases in sort of that 2 to 4-year-old age range. That's being seen nationwide, and it's consistent with what we're seeing here.
Most kids can be treated at home. Just keep them hydrated, give them age-appropriate medicines for their fever as needed, and make sure they get plenty of rest. If a child is over age 1, honey can help ease a cough. As for when to call the doctor, Ratner says use the same judgment you would anytime your kid is sick.
If there's a child who is breathing faster or seems like they're having trouble breathing, they're having more fever, then that's a situation where you probably do want to go to the pediatrician for evaluation.
If a kid needs an antibiotic, they'll likely get a macrolide like azithromycin. That's because amoxicillin, which is the go-to antibiotic for pediatricians, it doesn't work against mycoplasma pneumonia. Here's Dr. Preeti Sharma again.
The good news about mycoplasma is that it is not a new bacteria. It is easily treated with antibiotics. And usually kids feel better fairly readily after the correct antibiotic is started.
Sharma says kids can go back to school once they've been fever-free without the use of fever reducers for at least 24 hours, as long as they feel physically up to it. Just know that symptoms like cough and runny nose can stick around for weeks, and they could potentially still be shedding infectious droplets the whole time. Doctors say that's one reason why outbreaks of mycoplasma pneumonia tend to last a long time. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The 12-step program, made famous by Alcoholics Anonymous, resembles the process for Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous.
Nobody wants to talk about being in fetal position on the bathroom floor because someone didn't call you.
We also have news if you're in the fetal position about the election. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from KU Theater, presenting Hookman, a darkly comic salute to teenage slasher films, reminding everyone that college can be scary. Playing November 1st through November 7th. Tickets at KUTheater.com.
Stay tuned. Lines are coming up next to tell you more about the weather, and there's a lot to talk about. Next couple of days are going to be interesting. It is 4:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, an anthropologist who helped discover a Mayan site built thousands of years ago.
We can now see through the canopy without having to deforest it in real life, right? We can digitally deforest areas and see what's underneath.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. In northern Gaza, the Ministry of Health says at least 60 Palestinians were killed and more are missing after an Israeli airstrike overnight, the deadliest in weeks. This comes as medical and rescue services in the area have been severely hindered. Here's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf.
The strike hit a five-story building in the area of Beit Lehia, full of families of displaced Palestinians. At least 25 of those killed were children, according to health officials. Last week, the Israeli military demanded the Gaza Civil Defense first responder teams leave the area, meaning that there was no one to help pull bodies out of the rubble or administer first aid. The Israeli military also raided the closest hospital over the weekend, destroying much of it, including the morgue, according to hospital officials. So civilians were left to rescue people on their own and bury the dead in the street. The Israeli military says it's aware of civilian deaths, and the incident is, quote, being looked into. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
In the final days of the presidential campaign, evangelical Christian leaders are working to turn out their voters. In Paris, Sarah McCammon tells us white evangelicals remain a key Republican voting bloc.
About 8 in 10 white evangelicals supported former President Donald Trump in the past two elections, and polling suggests this year's numbers will be similar. Ralph Reed of the Faith and Freedom Coalition says his group is encouraging millions of evangelicals and conservative Catholics to vote. Reed says he's skeptical of efforts by supporters of Vice President Kamala Harris to turn out evangelicals on her behalf.
We encourage Christians of all political views to go out there and make a difference and be citizens, so I wouldn't want to discourage them, but I think it's largely been a waste of time and money.
Reed says this year's Get Out the Vote effort in several key states will be his group's largest and most ambitious operation yet. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks finished mixed today. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. First, let's turn to the weather. You may have noticed it's a bit windy here in the KPR listening area today. We have a wind advisory in effect for the entire KPR listening area through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. Most of us will see wind gusts up around 50 miles an hour at times, some places even higher. The other thing I want to alert you to, tonight we are expecting lows in the upper 60s. Tomorrow, slight chance of rain in the morning. Then, as we head through the afternoon tomorrow, a 50% chance of showers and storms, and some of these could be severe. So you need to get your action plan in place. We're not used to really seeing these kind of storms in this time of year. Generally, this really feels more like a July to August sort of event that we're expecting tomorrow. No guarantees that it's going to hit, but it never hurts to make a plan. Breezy tomorrow, highs in the mid-70s tomorrow night, a 70% chance of showers and storms in the evening. After they move through, and this could be a high wind event, could be a hail event, could see an isolated tornado here or there. After this all moves through by about midnight, expect the humidity to drop significantly, but then we're expecting a whole lot of rain over the weekend. So as I said, make your preparations now. Looks like we get a break from it all on Thursday, but starting on Friday night, all the way through to Monday, Tuesday of next week, we are expecting quite a bit of rain, so now is the time to make a plan. Republican members of a committee on medical marijuana say they need more information before recommending a bill to the full Kansas legislature. They voted yesterday not to immediately propose legalizing medical marijuana, but the committee will continue discussing the topic. Democrats like Representative Heather Meyer say lawmakers already know enough to form a basic proposal, pointing to bills that previously advanced but did not become law.
There's been quite a bit of work been done on this issue for several years, definitely before my time.
Some Republicans say they'd be more open to recommending a bill if their questions are addressed at the next hearing scheduled for January. Recent polls indicate more than 70% of Kansans support legalizing medical marijuana. Kansas is one of 12 states where it remains illegal. You're listening to KPR, and the time is 4:35.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Hackers are putting lives at risk at hundreds of hospitals across the United States. And a new report from tech giant Microsoft says it's only getting worse. NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin reports.
Everything went down. And nothing was communicated amongst anyone.
Dina Carlisle is a registered nurse from Michigan. She's also a union president representing hundreds of nurses who work at Ascension Providence Rochester Hospital.
So May 8th, my people over at Ascension called me and they said, "We think everything just went down. We're not sure."
It was the nightmare scenario. Criminal hackers broke into Ascension Healthcare, a network of over 100 private Catholic hospitals and senior living facilities across the United States. The nurses were in the dark, Carlisle said. In some cases, they couldn't even find their patients in the hospital. For Carlisle, it was clear. Hackers were putting patients' lives in danger.
We just lived through a pandemic, and it was the worst amount of death I've ever seen. And then to think, what could ever be this bad? You know, it's like, and here it is.
For a healthcare professional to compare the experience of enduring the COVID-19 pandemic to caring for patients during a ransomware attack, Carlisle's story is personal. It's unfortunately one of many. But lately, researchers have also been working to gather hard data to illustrate the impacts of this crisis. The numbers are disturbing. According to a new report from Microsoft, ransomware attacks on healthcare have gone up over 300% since 2015. Here's Shara DeGrippo, the report's author.
Healthcare and hospitals are a target that threat actors love because they have an urgency around getting back up and running, and they tend to have patient care as their number one focus, meaning any time lost is not acceptable.
The report also relies on research from an emergency room doctor who also happens to be a cybersecurity expert.
You know, we're continuing to see these attacks impact the care of patients. It's increasingly untenable from a national security perspective, and that's something that terrifies me.
Dr. Christian Demeff is at the University of California, San Diego. He co-founded UCSD's Center for Healthcare Cybersecurity. One of the center's biggest findings, a key part of Microsoft's report, is that a ransomware attack impacts healthcare in an entire region. If one hospital is hit, a nearby hospital is suddenly flooded with emergency room patients. Doctors are overloaded and can't always prevent healthcare emergencies like strokes or heart attacks.
As we've recognized this as a human issue, a whether or not patients will survive question, not just whether or not their privacy will be preserved, that's given me hope.
Hope, because DeMaff thinks his community is starting to get their arms around the problem. But mapping its contours isn't easy. According to UC San Diego, 70% of a hospital's digital connections come from medical devices like CT scanners, rather than computers, creating a complex web of vulnerable and critical services. Going forward, it will take a complex web of experts to tackle this problem.
Doctors and nurses and economists and policy folk, you have to bring all those folks to the table to make up the next generation of solutions that are really going to help keep patients safe.
That includes everything from training young doctors and nurses to revert to paper when networks are down, to building a backup system of replacement technology that can be used in a crisis. It's about being more resilient, because at this point, every hospital is a target. Dina Carlisle, the nurse and union president in Michigan, is clear-headed on the stakes.
I think at some time, we're all a patient, we're having babies, grandchildren, our parents are getting older. It's so important that we make sure this cyber safety is in place so that our patients are safe.
So that all of us patients are safe. Jenna McLaughlin, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
Researchers have discovered a Mayan site hidden deep in the jungle on the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. They've named the site Valeriana, and it's thought to have been built over 1,000 years ago. Surveying an area of 50 square miles, the study revealed more than 6,000 structures, including stone pyramids similar to those found at the most famous sites of Mayan ruins. The dense jungle kept Valeriana hidden from the scientific community, but archaeologists found the settlements with an aerial mapping technology called LIDAR. Marcello Canuto is a professor of anthropology at Tulane University and a co-author on the study. He joins us now. Welcome, and congratulations for discovering an ancient Mayan settlement. Yeah?
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation.
Of course. So can you just first paint a picture of what Valeriana probably looked like at its height? Like, what kind of structures did you find? How was this settlement laid out?
This was a hilly landscape, and on top of these hills are these large temples, these large pyramids, and all around would have been other small settlements or other houses. The landscape would be a mosaic of some forest patches, agricultural features, and even roads and or trails. So you could walk from one house to another and then eventually come to the center of the city where there would be maybe a market or where a ball court where they would be playing the rubber ball game, right? And you would go and visit the center for particular economic activities or because of rituals and then maybe in the afternoon go home.
And just for context, in terms of its size, how would you compare the size of Valeriana compared to other prominent Mayan settlements that have already been discovered?
There are a lot of very famous lowland Maya sites, such as Tikal in Guatemala or Calakmul in Mexico that's nearby, that are these really behemoths. This site isn't that size. These medium-sized sites would have been administrative and religious centers, and very likely also centers where people came and traded.
So the story is it was actually one of your students who discovered this site with data that he found on Google, right?
That's right.
Tell us about how he stumbled on that data, and what was this data that you all eventually analyzed?
So Luke, my PhD student, Luke Al Thomas, had been reading about LIDAR data that had been recently published. And LIDAR, it's basically a pulse of light that's sent from a sensor, and it measures the distance between the sensor and the phenomenon that's bouncing back the light. And so years earlier, a research group had done a LIDAR survey of this area for completely different reasons. It had nothing to do with archaeology. And so we downloaded the data and began to analyze it for archaeological purposes.
Did you ever imagine that your job as an archaeologist and anthropologist would look like this, sifting through mounds and mounds of data on a computer instead of hacking through the jungle with a machete like Indiana Jones?
The answer is unequivocally, I never imagined this.
You would rather be Indiana Jones.
Exactly. You're a kid. You're just like, okay, I'm going to go out there and so forth. But I'll tell you this. What's really exciting about this is not that suddenly we just sit in front of computer screens only, right? What the computer screens allow us to do and all the data that we can see allow us to be really efficient in the field. We know where we need to go. We know what we need to see. Whereas before we would go to the jungle, but we would be always worried that we're missing something,
yeah.
Right? Now we are a little bit more armed with information.
Yeah.
So to a certain extent, I think it makes me want to go there more, right? In other words, I know that I am going to have a really fruitful month or two in the jungle.
Anthropology professor Marcello Canuto of Tulane University, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Laura Lorson. Over the past 25 years, wind turbines have been sprouting up all over Kansas. Today, nearly 4,000 of them dot the landscape. About 400 of them are taller than the Statue of Liberty. While much of the nation has embraced this form of renewable energy, commentator Rex Buchanan tells us we still haven't curbed our appetite for fossil fuels.
Lately, I've been working on a book project that involves revisiting some places in the state, places I last saw about 20 years ago. In that 20 years, some parts of the Kansas landscape haven't really changed all that much, but some have. Maybe the biggest change is related to energy. Just about everywhere you go in the state, you see wind farms. Some of them, like the one near Montezuma in southwestern Kansas, have been around for a long time. Others, like the ones that line I-70 out by Colby, are newer. We've heard a lot about the advent of wind power in Kansas. Kansas is now among the country's leaders in wind generation, producing almost half the electricity used in the state. You've probably seen the maps showing about 40 wind farms scattered across Kansas. But until you see them in person, especially their scale, it's hard to comprehend just how big wind power has become. The wind farm in Ellsworth County lines 24 miles of I-70. And today's turbines are big, much larger than the ones near Montezuma. With all that wind power has come another change in the landscape, new transmission lines. The electricity generated by wind turbines must be carried to where it's needed, and that's made for lots more large-scale transmission lines. According to National Stories, development of new wind generation has slowed across the country. At the same time, solar energy is picking up. People in Douglas County, and many parts of the state for that matter, know about proposals for these new large installations. One's already operating in Stanton County out in far southwestern Kansas. It's about 75,000 panels spread out over 144 acres. A much bigger one is under construction east of Medicine Lodge in Barber County, expected to come online next year. In short, Kansas is contributing mightily to the increased production of renewable energy. But that contribution hasn't come easy. Locating some of these facilities has been and continues to be contentious, to say the least. Yet maybe the statistic that I find most striking is that in spite of all the additional renewable energy production in Kansas and across the country, fossil fuel consumption nationwide hasn't really gone down all that much. On a percentage basis, we still use fossil fuels for roughly 80% of our energy. That's maybe down a little from a few years ago, but not down all that much. Renewables still account for about 20% of the energy we use. While the production of renewable energy goes up, so does the overall amount of energy we use. Renewables can take up the slack, help us satisfying that new demand, but that doesn't necessarily translate to dramatically using less fossil fuel. Now, if you care about climate change, and I can't quite see why you wouldn't, that last statistic about our continued reliance on fossil fuel makes apparent just how hard it'll be to mitigate climate change. We've come a long way when it comes to renewables. Driving across the state makes that clear. But we've still got a long, rough way to go.
Commentator Rex Buchanan is a writer, author, and director emeritus of the Kansas Geological Survey. He lives in Lawrence. From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 99.5 FM in Manhattan, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Don't let your aging RV take you for a ride. KPR's vehicle donation program will gladly take it off your hands so we can help fund the news and music programming you enjoy. Donate your car, truck, boat, or RV online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Stay tuned. Coming up in our next half hour, news headlines, of course. Then we're going to talk with Deirdre Walsh. You know, a week from today, voters will be electing a new president. Maybe you voted early, maybe you voted absentee, but Election Day is a week from today, and it will decide not only on a new president, but who controls the Senate and who controls the U.S. House of Representatives. So what exactly is at stake? What do each plan to do if they take power? We will tell you coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Woodhaven, Inc., manufacturing custom deck and siding solutions using sustainable woods and powered exclusively by wind energy. Located in Perry with shipping available to the entire KPR listing area. Details at woodhavenproducts.com.
Gusty winds causing all kinds of problems, particularly if you are driving on an east-west oriented highway. You're probably noticing this right now if you are on I-70. I was actually on 31st Street in Lawrence earlier this morning, and I drive a compact car, so it was just kind of like, let's hope for the best. Blowing me around out there, and perhaps it is you as well. We do have a wind advisory through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. It's 10 minutes before 5.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 50 years ago in Boston, someone threatened to set off a nuclear bomb. It was a hoax, but it led to the creation of a secretive government squad to handle nuclear emergencies. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports on this rarely seen group and what they're up to today.
In an aircraft hangar at Joint Base Andrews, just outside of Washington, D.C., the government's first line of response to nuclear emergencies gathered to celebrate its 50th anniversary. There was cake and drinks and speeches, but right from the start, it was clear this was not an ordinary birthday party.
A quick admin announcement before we go further. I have to note this is an unclassified event, so please understand that there is a lot that our people are not going to be able to discuss.
This group is known as the Nuclear Emergency Support Team, or NEST, like a bird's nest. The team is mostly made up of people who work elsewhere in government, scientists, federal law enforcement personnel, regulators. They all take time out of their day jobs to prepare for a nuclear incident. Think of it as a volunteer fire department, except the volunteers have high-level security clearances and they respond to nuclear threats.
When it comes to a radiological or nuclear event, NEST's mission at the very core of it is providing that scientific advice about either what has happened or what could happen.
G. Tilden oversaw NEST for several years at the Department of Energy and has written a history of its activities. A lot of what it's done sounds like it belongs in a spy thriller. In 1978, NEST deployed in Canada's remote Northwest Territories to recover debris from a crashed Soviet reconnaissance satellite that was powered by uranium. A year later, NEST helicopters circled over the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant after one of the plant's reactors partially melted down. NEST experts and equipment also went to Fukushima, Japan, after a nuclear power plant there melted down and spewed a plume of radioactivity across the countryside.
It was to help the Japanese government understand what is being released from the damaged reactors and where is that plume going? Where is it depositing on the ground?
That kind of information is critical to determining how to respond to a nuclear incident, who needs to evacuate, for example. Teams also train on how to deal with nuclear dirty bombs and nuclear weapons that are lost or damaged. NEST has always kept a low profile, partially because almost everything it does related to nuclear weapons and nuclear terrorism is classified, but also because it doesn't want to alarm people. At the same time, Jay Tilden says they don't want to be seen as a shadowy government agency flying around in black helicopters.
We didn't even want them dark gray because they look like military. We wanted to be very distinct that we're a civil agency, and when those aircraft are flying, they're flying largely for a public health and safety mission.
The helicopters are two-toned blue and gray, and the government agents who fly them around, not men in black, it's folks like Jacqueline Brandon.
When I found out as a scientist I get to fly in a helicopter and do real national security missions, I was like, sign me up right away.
Brandon is a PhD physical chemist who sits in the back scanning for signs of radioactivity as the helicopter flies low to the ground.
To me, it's like a roller coaster ride. I love it.
She's airborne a lot. This year alone, NEST aircraft had flown above the Super Bowl, both Democratic and Republican national conventions. And then there's the events they haven't planned for.
They happen periodically. So.
And what happens for you if there's an on-call event? Like, what's your life like?
Exciting. Well, pack all of our gear up and be in the air in 4 hours, and then flying over whatever we're trying to fly over.
Brandon didn't want to get into too many specifics about what might call a Nest team out, but Wendon Smith, who's the current head of Nest, was willing to talk about it, kind of.
We don't provide the details, but I would say on a weekly basis, there's either an unknown event that triggers the deployment of an S team or a question from a local responder.
Smith is at the Energy Department. She says nuclear materials are more part of daily life than most people realize. They're used in oil and gas drilling and in a lot of medical applications. Sometimes people are even injected with radioactive dye to aid with medical imaging. In fact, somebody with radioactive dye in their body might have caused a recent Nest response. After local police found a suspicious puddle in a fast food parking lot somewhere in America. I can neither confirm or deny, but
if someone doesn't use a public restroom and happens to alleviate their need in a parking lot, then that can cause a troubled signature if there is indeed a medical isotope involved.
Hypothetically, if you do get injected with a radioactive isotope as part of a medical scan, Smith asks you use the restroom. Of course, Nest prepares for far worse. They don't want to say what exactly, but they do want you to know that after 50 years, they're still going strong.
The fact that people understand that Nest exists and what its mission is and how successfully we perform it is important to help people sleep at night.
The government's volunteer nuclear fire department stands ready. Just in case. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
A series of attacks on ballot drop boxes in the Portland, Oregon area have officials there on high alert. Police say two fires set in ballot boxes on Monday are connected to a third incident. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Dirk Vanderhart reports.
The calls came in rapid succession. At 3:30 a.m. Monday, Portland police were alerted to a fire at a ballot box outside of county election headquarters. A half hour later, police in the neighboring city of Vancouver, Washington, responded to a blaze at a drop box there, this one at a transit center. A local news crew showed up in time to grab footage of officials shoveling smoldering ballots onto a rainy sidewalk. Police say the two fires were set by the same person or people, using a device designed to ignite the paper inside. And they link Monday's fires to a failed October 8th attack on a separate Vancouver ballot box. Mike Benner is a spokesperson for Portland Police.
There was enough evidence collected at all three scenes that lead us to believe that all three incidents are connected.
The damage was limited. In the Portland fire, just three ballots were burned, but possibly hundreds were destroyed in the Washington incident. Election officials say voters who used the box can ask for a replacement ballot. The fires could affect a tight U.S. House race in Southwest Washington. Oregon and Washington have long voted by mail and drop box, and the attacks have rattled election workers like Multnomah County, Oregon Elections Director Tim Scott.
I've been with Multnomah County Elections for 16 years. I've been in elections for 22 years. This is the first time any incident has occurred.
Authorities haven't announced a motive in the incidents. Police are looking for a dark-colored Volvo that may be connected to the fires. The FBI is also investigating. Ballot boxes have been under increasing scrutiny in recent years, says Max Reed. He's a senior research manager for elections at the nonprofit Institute for Strategic Dialogue.
Ballot drop boxes have been subject of conspiracy theories and false claims about their security since 2020. They've been a focus at different times for some extremist groups and other election integrity groups.
In the Portland area, police are stepping up patrols around ballot boxes, and officials like Scott are asking voters to be alert.
Anyone who sees any suspicious activity around a ballot drop site, please reach out, call us, let us know.
But the overarching message from Scott and other officials is simply this: vote. For NPR News, I'm Dirk Vanderhart in Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
The 12-step program for Alcoholics Anonymous resembles the process for Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. Hear more on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. A wind advisory is in effect until 7 a.m. for the entire KPR listening area. It's 5 o'clock.
We've been preparing not to put the carpet before us, but be prepared to lead. We're going to have a very aggressive first 100 days agenda for the Congress.
On Capitol Hill, both Republicans and Democrats are eyeing what they would do first if their party wins control of the House.
For Tuesday, October 29th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, the very complicated relationship between the GOP presidential nominee and the GOP governor of Georgia.
And how's it playing out for Georgia voters this election season?
I don't want to oversell it. It is important, and it's important marginally. But we have an election that will be determined on the margins.
Plus, a new housing program in Pennsylvania that aims to help homeowners stay put.
People have treated the housing quality issue as separate from the affordability issue. They are two sides of the same coin.
Those stories after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Vice President Harris is set to speak tonight from the Ellipse in Washington, D.C., with the White House in the background. As NPR's Tamara Keith explains, her campaign says she'll be making her closing argument to voters.
Harris will speak from the same site where on January 6, 2021, then-President Donald Trump told his supporters to fight like hell before a mob of them stormed the Capitol building. Harris campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon says tonight's remarks are aimed at breaking through to the last remaining undecided voters. With Election Day just a week away.
We know a lot of these undecided voters, they're exhausted. They're certainly frustrated by the state of the partisanship and divided political system that really was defined under Donald Trump, his chaos.
She says Harris will argue it's time to turn the page on the Trump era and will discuss her plans to improve the lives of Americans. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
As he has in the past when political events he was involved in have turned ugly, former President Donald Trump is seeking to portray a rally this past weekend at Madison Square Garden as a love fest.
I don't think anybody has ever seen anything like what happened the other night at Madison Square Garden. The love in that room. It was breathtaking.
Trump used equally fond terms to describe the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol in 2020. Some participants at Sunday's rally in New York made racist and otherwise offensive comments, including a comedian who characterized Puerto Rico as a floating ocean of garbage. The former president is campaigning in Pennsylvania tonight. The Biden administration is awarding nearly $3 billion as part of any effort to shore up the nation's ports. The money will go for things like fixing aging infrastructure and making those facilities more environmentally friendly. President Biden made the announcement today at the Port of Baltimore, where a container ship took out a major bridge, killing six construction workers and causing months of disruption for shippers. The initiative is aimed at making improvements at 55 sites nationwide. A new rule requires airlines in the U.S. to give their passengers cash refunds if flights are significantly delayed or canceled. Here's NPR's Joel Rose.
The Department of Transportation's new rule mandates that airlines must hand out refunds, not vouchers, even if passengers haven't explicitly asked for one. The refund rule applies to flights that are canceled and also to flights that are, quote, significantly changed if passengers choose not to accept the modified itinerary. In a statement, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said passengers deserve to get their money back when an airline owes them without headaches or haggling. The refund rule also applies to flights delayed more than 3 hours for domestic routes and 6 hours for international flights. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow fell 154 points. The Nasdaq was up 145 points. You're listening to NPR. Actress Terry Garr died at her home in Los Angeles from complications of multiple sclerosis. She was 79. A gifted comedian, Garr was a fixture in Hollywood films from the 1970s through the 90s, with her charm and affability was often a guest on talk shows. Jeff London has this remembrance.
Terry Garr began her career as a dancer. Her mother was a Rockette, and she appeared in several Elvis Presley films. Mel Brooks hired her to play opposite Gene Wilder in Young Frankenstein, and a career of many comic and dramatic roles was launched. She was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Mr. Mom, and received an Oscar nomination for Tootsie.
I don't care about I Love You. I read The Second Sex. I read The Cinderella Complex. I'm responsible for my own orgasm. I don't care. I just don't like to be lied to.
Garr also hosted Saturday Night Live 3 times and appeared frequently on Johnny Carson's and David Letterman's late night shows. In 1999, she was diagnosed with MS and became a spokesperson for research. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
It's been dubbed the Halloween Comet by NASA. A recently discovered comet blew apart as it approached the sun, and it happened on camera. Space Agency says a sun-observing spacecraft captured the moment when the comet broke into chunks this week. Researchers have been tracking it since it was discovered in September by a telescope in Hawaii. It was thought to be part of a family of comets that pass incredibly close to the sun. Crude oil futures prices fell further today, oil down 17 cents a barrel to end the session at $67.21 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Public Library, offering downloadable ebooks, audiobooks, streaming movies, and more, all available with a library card. Card information at lplks.org.
Lows in the upper 60s tonight, still breezy. Wind gusts up to 50 miles per hour tonight. It's 5:06.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. A week from now, voters will elect a new president. They will also decide who controls both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The new president, whether it's Vice President Kamala Harris or former President Donald Trump, they will need allies on Capitol Hill. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins me here in the studio to talk about what is at stake. Hey, Kay, Deirdre.
Hey, great to be with you.
Start big picture. Are we expecting major shifts in power on Capitol Hill?
Well, as you know, the margins on the Hill in both chambers are super skinny. Democrats have a 2-seat Senate majority. Republicans in the House have a 4-seat majority. So just a small number of contests are really going to decide which party controls both of these chambers. But that has major implications for the kinds of issues party leaders are going to move in terms of votes. Republican and Democratic leaders are planning very different agendas and have very different approaches on issues that have real life impacts on people's lives in terms of taxes, immigration, healthcare. And, you know, if we end up with divided government like we've just had, the next president could face a major check from Congress on their power and may have to look at executive orders, which is a much more limiting way to govern.
Sure. Okay, so let's take this one at a time, chamber by chamber. Senate first. What does it look like? What might happen there?
It's a very tough map this year for Democrats. And right now, Republicans appear to have the edge to pick up enough seats to win control. They're expected to win a seat in West Virginia, where Joe Manchin's retiring, and are in good shape in Montana, where it's a solidly red state, where Democratic Senator John Tester has been trailing his Republican challenger. Democrats are just defending more seats in purple states than Republicans are.
You're describing what sounds like a pretty plausible path for Republicans to take control of the Senate if, and it's if, but if that is what happens, what are they going to do with it?
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump's agenda is the Senate Republican agenda. If he wins, border security is front and center. Senate Republicans are also looking to move a major tax bill. Trump's tax cuts from 2017 expire at the end of 2025. He wants to lower the corporate tax rate and renew a lot of the other tax breaks that are expiring. In the terms of the economy, there is one issue that's complicated for Senate Republicans, and that's Trump's tariffs. Not all of them support them, but Trump has also said he could move on those alone and without Congress. Another major issue is there could be Supreme Court like housing, the child tax credit, and adding tax increases on wealthier Americans.
Okay, let's mosey over to the House side, which, of course, Republicans currently control. Are they likely to keep control?
I mean, it is going to be a coin flip. It is really tight. House Speaker Mike Johnson has been really confident campaigning across the country. He said he expects full Republican control. He's already coordinating plans for the agenda with former President Trump.
So we've been preparing, not to put the cart before the horse, but we prepare to lead. We're going to have a very aggressive first 100 days agenda for the Congress. As I told President Trump, I said, Mr. President, you could be the most consequential president of the modern era because we have to fix almost everything.
He's promising a vote immediately on border security. Also, votes on taxes would come next and changes to federal regulations.
Okay. We have about 30 seconds left, Deirdre. You said it is close. What are House Democratic leaders planning to do if they regain control?
It is a very different list of policy priorities. If Democrats win the House, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries would be positioned to be the first Black Speaker of the House. I've spent some time on the trail with him in a couple of places, and he's vowed to bring up a federal bill to protect voting rights. Mm-hmm. He's also saying that they will move a bill to protect reproductive freedom. And he's also talking about housing costs as a top issue.
Okie dokie. NPR's Deirdre Walsh, thank you.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
The country's massive housing shortage is getting worse because some of the most affordable homes are falling apart. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports that that is fueling a push to not only build more housing, but also help people stay in the places they already have.
In rural western Pennsylvania, the tiny borough of Glen Campbell was settled as a coal mining town, and the houses are old.
Melissa?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Melissa and Robert Cox think their cozy but crumbling three-bedroom dates to the 20s or 30s. It was all Melissa could afford when she left a bad marriage with her three children. She bought it rent-to-own a dozen years ago, $7,000 total. But it's come with a slew of costly problems.
Just be careful. These steps are okay.
Robert leads the way to the basement.
Sorry about the smell, but up to this point, we had sewage backing up.
He points out an open shower drain in a corner. When it rains, sewage seeps in because the old terracotta piping broke. In another corner, the home's original foundation, made of rocks and cement, is peeling away. Then we head up to the second floor bedrooms.
When I moved in here, it was raining in this room, so we had to completely redo this.
Where was the water coming in?
Over here. There was a closet, which was ripped out, and now it's the boys' room.
Melissa is a family therapist. She got a recent raise to $25 an hour. Robert is on disability for an autoimmune disease. They've struggled to put in new floors, new siding, a new roof.
When I did the roof, my uncle co-signed on a loan for me to do it because I didn't even have any credit.
But they got a cheap roofer and say the work was shoddy. Meanwhile, there's that awful sewage smell.
I would be putting air fresheners in the vents sticking them everywhere on top of the dehumidifiers. I mean, I've dumped bleach down there to try and take the smell away, vinegar.
Across the U.S., nearly 7 million households face problems like this, and that's likely an undercount. They're disproportionately poor and people of color. Todd Swanstrom of the University of Missouri St. Louis calls it trickle down. Developers build new places for better off people while older homes deteriorate until they're deemed affordable, like the Cox's home in Pennsylvania. They're often starter homes, but he says lower income families have nowhere near the means to fix or maintain them.
People have treated the housing quality issue as separate from the affordability issue. And in fact, there are two sides of the same coin.
Nationally, there's a patchwork of home repair programs, federal, state, and nonprofit. But Swanstrom says they're underfunded, with years-long wait lists and lots of restrictions on how the money can be spent.
You might get $5,000 or $6,000 to weatherize your home. But meanwhile, the roof is leaking. Well, what good does it do to weatherize the home if the roof is leaking, right?
A first-of-its-kind program in Pennsylvania aims to help. Whole home repairs was enacted 2 years ago, and here's how it's different. It's more flexible with how money can be spent, and that makes it easier to fix the most urgent problems, then coordinate with other repair programs that could kick in more money. The goal is to help not just families, but entire communities damaged by disrepair.
I see more and more vacant houses yearly just being abandoned.
Lou Ann Zack helps direct planning in Indiana County, where the Cox family lives. She says the whole home repairs program is making a difference, and she thinks of another woman who'd been asking the county for help for decades.
She applied back in the 1990s, and we would always run out of funding before we would get to her. So we finally, with this program, are able to come in.
The state program is funded by pandemic aid, and counties coordinate the repairs. They decide who qualifies based on income and can spend up to $50,000 per household. There's also money for construction workforce training to combat an industry shortage.
And then they're going to put railings here and replace these steps.
In Glen Campbell, Melissa and Robert Cox say repairs on their house will start soon. They'll include making the tiny first-floor bathroom more accessible for Robert and their oldest son, who has Down syndrome and can struggle with walking. Robert says they are grateful.
I just brought all my kids down, and we prayed about it, and I thank God for it, because it is a blessing. It is a blessing.
Several states have taken up this model for repairs, and a proposal in Congress would scale it nationally. But Pennsylvania lawmakers did not renew funding for it this year, leaving 18,000 homeowners on the wait list. Supporters say they'll try again. For now, counties are spending down what they have. Among the lucky ones is Velma Fischel, whose house was built in 1890.
I've been here since 93.
One day a few years ago, she leaned back in her chair and saw
by NPR's Marisa Peñalosa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio. We broadcast at 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.9 FM in Atchison, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from In Equatoria. Andrew Sherwood, Ph.D., Jungian analyst. C.G. Jung suggested that dreams are intentional messages from the unconscious that, when interpreted correctly, provide balance and guidance in life. More at workingwithdreams.com.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next half hour, more than 50 million people have already cast their ballot in this year's election. So the question is, what can this early voting data tell us, if anything? Ashley Lopez will look into that. We'll hear from David Folkenflik on the continued fallout from the Washington Post deciding not to endorse any candidate for president. Subscribers are absolutely deserting this publication. And David will talk about why. We will also learn about an effort to engage young Latinos in Southwest Kansas in political action. It's all coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
The Kansas City Jazz Orchestra brings the swing on Saturday night, December 14th, at KPR's annual Big Band Christmas Concert at Liberty Hall, a great way to kick off your holiday season. Tickets are on sale now at Liberty Hall and at Ticketmaster.com. You can find out more at KansasPublicRadio.org. Quick reminder, though you probably know this just by looking out the window, we have a wind advisory for the entire KPR listening area through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. It's 5:20.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Former President Donald Trump campaigned in Georgia on Monday. Missing from the stage was the state's popular Republican governor, Brian Kemp. The former president's relationship with the governor is complicated. That could matter to some voters in a state that Trump narrowly lost 4 years ago. WABE's Sam Greenglass reports from Atlanta.
At an Atlanta rally in August, Trump had harsh words for Georgia's governor.
He's a disloyal guy, and he's a very average governor. Little Brian Kemp, bad guy.
The two fell out after 2020, when Kemp rebuffed Trump's efforts to overturn Georgia's election result. Kemp went on to a decisive re-election victory in 2022, despite opposition from Trump. So when Trump continued to slam one of the most popular politicians in a crucial swing state, many Republicans, like strategist Brian Robinson, scratched their heads.
For Trump, Georgia is a must-win, and he learned a lesson pretty quick in August that going after Brian Kemp was a really bad strategic move.
Though Kemp told reporters he cast a blank ballot in the GOP primary, he did say he would support the Republican nominee no matter what. And in a September Fox interview, he made clear he was behind Trump. That opened the door for Trump and Kemp to patch things up. The two men shook hands, not at a campaign event, but after surveying damage from Hurricane Helene.
Well, Brian, thank you very much. Your governor's doing a fantastic job, I will tell you that. And
Kemp hasn't attended any Trump rallies so far. In the final weeks, Kemp has hosted his own Get Out the Vote events, including this breakfast for an incumbent lawmaker in a toss-up district. Kemp barely nods at the presidential race.
We don't have Bruce Springsteen. We don't have Julia Roberts. We are workhorses, not show horses.
But beyond that dig at Democrats, he doesn't reference Trump in his remarks. At this genteel country club, Kemp frames his pitch around Republicans' record running state government, like cutting taxes. Pressed by reporters after, on the deck overlooking the golf course, Kemp affirms he's still pulling for Trump, despite their history.
You know, this is not about me, and it's not about him. It's about the people of this country and what they want. Do they really think they're better off right now than they were 4 years ago?
Kemp has built up his own sophisticated political operation, now seen as far superior to the Georgia GOP. Kemp's political action committees are spending roughly $3 million on door knocking, phone banking, and mail. The efforts are focused on competitive state legislative districts in Georgia and opposing Vice President Kamala Harris.
Well, I want to win. So we're all fighting to make sure we win from the top of the ticket all the way down to the bottom.
Kemp and Trump need each other, Robinson says.
If Donald Trump is president, he could be helpful or create a major hurdle for Brian Kemp in his future political endeavors.
And for Trump, Robinson says Kemp may help give uneasy independents and Republicans permission to vote for the former president.
I don't want to oversell it. It is important, and it's important marginally. But we have an election that will be determined on the margins.
Wearing a floral dress at the Kemp event, Tracy D'Arcy is one of the voters who's not enthusiastic about Trump or Harris.
I would love if we had different nominees for both parties, honestly. Nikki Haley would have been amazing.
D'Arcy thinks the restrictive abortion law signed by Kemp is too tight and laments the confusion caused by the overturn of Roe v. Wade, which Trump has praised. But she's also worried by Harris's liberal record as a senator. She says she tends to trust her governor's judgment.
I think he's a very level person. I think he is reasonable. It definitely weighs in on sort of which way I might decide to vote.
So D'Arcy has a choice to make in a key state decided in 2020 by less than 12,000 votes. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
In 1882, the accidental death of a prominent member of the indigenous community of Angoon, Alaska, led to an escalation with the U.S. Navy. The Navy bombarded the entire village, decimating the community and killing at least six children. For decades, the community of Angoon has been asking for an apology, and this past weekend, close to a century and a half later, they finally got one. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has this story.
142 years ago, Angoon went up in flames. Ashkuge Ka Yanasach, Barbara Cadiente Nelson's grandmother, survived the bombardment as a young woman.
Can you imagine my grandmother at 26 having to scramble and run with her family? And the fear, the real fear.
According to oral accounts of villagers who survived the bombardment, it all started because a Tlingit shaman for the community was killed in a whaling accident. U.S. government documents at the time claimed other Tlingit villagers took two of the white whaling crew as prisoners and demanded compensation of 200 blankets from the whaling company. Tlingit accounts deny that prisoners were taken. Then the U.S. Navy got involved. They said the village wasn't owed anything, and in fact would be fined 400 blankets for taking prisoners.
They scrambled to come up with blankets at the onset of winter.
They only delivered about 80, and as a result, the Navy attacked. Since the 1980s, representatives from Angoon have been asking for an apology. In June of this year, the Navy announced that they would issue one. They planned it with Angoon elders for the anniversary of the attack, October 26th. On Saturday, hundreds of Tlingit people gathered in the Angoon High School gym. Angoon elders opened the event with a traditional Tlingit song and dance. U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Mark Sakato presented the apology.
The United States Navy hereby apologizes on behalf of the United States Navy to all the Tlingit peoples of Angoon for the pain, suffering, and generational trauma inflicted by the bombardment of their village. Acknowledges that the Tlingit people of Angoon did not deserve nor provoke the bombardment and subsequent destruction of their village by United States naval forces.
As he finished, the gym filled with applause. Then clan elders responded. Here's Alan Zuboff.
Admiral Sakato, the dog salmon, are very happy to say we accept your apology.
And Dan Johnson, Jr.
None of us in this room will ever forget
ever. We will take it to our graves. We will teach it to our children.
Still, Kadiente Nelson says many in the community have mixed emotions about the apology.
How do you restore a human being? How do you restore a family? How do you restore a community who have been the target of annihilation?
But for Shkendu Ton George, telling the right story of what happened is a good first step. She's a retired high school teacher who taught this event to her students for 20 years.
It doesn't matter how many times I talk about it, how many times I talk with students about what happened. Like, every time I tear up. It's going to be amazing to be able to say the right thing happened, you know, finally.
She says she's relieved this apology will finally be part of the story. For NPR News, I'm Yvonne Krumrie in Angoon.
This is NPR News.
The 12-step program, made famous by Alcoholics Anonymous, resembles the process for Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous.
Nobody wants to talk about being in fetal position on the bathroom floor because someone didn't call you.
We also have news if you're in the fetal position about the election on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition, the very latest national, international, and regional news. Jay Schaefer's your local host. He'll have updates on the weather. Quick reminder, we do have a wind advisory for the entire KPR listening area through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Support for KPR comes from the Taco Zone Catering, your locally owned and operated small business featuring a reimagined menu and expanded catering options for larger parties. Details at thetacozone.com.
Stick around. News headlines are up next. It's 5:30.
All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Man-made waterfalls are keeping wells from running dry in Orange County, California.
In terms of production capacity, this is the largest water recycling facility of its kind.
Plus, the Washington Post is hemorrhaging subscribers 1 week and counting before Election Day.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Former President Trump is facing growing calls to apologize for disparaging comments that were made about Puerto Ricans during his recent campaign rally in New York. NPR's Windsor Johnson says Trump is campaigning today in the crucial swing state of Pennsylvania, with 7 days to go before the general election.
The remarks from a warm-up comedian referring to Puerto Rico as a floating island of garbage quickly spread through Pennsylvania. Trump will hold a rally tonight in Allentown, which is home to some 30,000 Puerto Rican residents, with some there saying they plan to protest the event. Some political analysts say the comments could give Vice President Kamala Harris a last-minute edge to win over some of the state's Latino voters.
NPR's Windsor Johnston. Earlier today, Trump called the Madison Square Garden rally a love fest, roughly the same way he referred to the violent January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. A federal judge in Pennsylvania has tossed out a Republican lawsuit that challenged the swing state's voter registration process for U.S. citizens living abroad. NPR's Hansi Luong reports.
In the ruling for the Pennsylvania case, U.S. District Judge Christopher Connor cited multiple procedural problems with the lawsuit brought by a group of House Republicans. They sued after the state started mailing out ballots to U.S. citizens living abroad, including military members. The judge also pointed out they're challenging rules for registering overseas voters that were first released more than 2 years ago. Last week, a Michigan state judge threw out a similar lawsuit by the Republican National Committee, calling it a, quote, 11th-hour attempt to disenfranchise voters. In North Carolina, a judge rejected the RNC's request for some overseas voters' ballots to be set aside after finding no evidence that anyone has ever fraudulently claimed to be an overseas voter and voted in a North Carolina election. Hansi Luong, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks finished mixed. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. I want to start with a quick look at the weather. You may have noticed it has been quite windy throughout the KPR listening area today. We do have a wind advisory in effect for the entire KPR listening area through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. Tomorrow afternoon, we do have a chance of showers and storms in the afternoon. We could be seeing severe weather moving into the Lawrence, Manhattan, Topeka area starting around 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. This is all very up in the air. Lots of things will affect this, but we're saying through the meat of the afternoon into the early evening, that's when we're expecting some fairly serious storms to be moving through the area, so you need to make your plans now. 70% chance of showers and storms through the evening hours, clearing finally after midnight. Now, if you're in the Kansas City area, expect this to start moving into your area after about 8 p.m. and running through about 2 a.m., something like that. It just kind of depends on how this front sets up. Once it's all through, it's going to be significantly cooler. Sunshine, clear skies on Thursday, then rain moving in on Friday night. And we are expecting to see rain in significant amounts through the beginning of next week. It could include Election Day. A survey by the Docking Institute at Fort Hays State University suggests that state lawmakers don't always represent the views of Kansas voters on the issue of abortion. Around 65% of people responding to the Kansas Speaks survey agreed that women are in a better position than politicians to decide whether to get an abortion. That includes just under half of Republicans. Slightly over half of respondents said they oppose recent laws passed by Kansas lawmakers restricting access to abortion. A quarter said they support those laws. Another quarter said they're neutral or they don't know. Alexandra Middlewood is a political science professor at Wichita State University.
And that goes against the trend that we're seeing in the Kansas State Legislature, and we're just continuing to see that support grow for abortion access.
Kansans are not voting directly on abortion this election, but voters will determine whether Republicans maintain their supermajority in the legislature. And Wichita State University leaders say Wichita could be the perfect site for the first school of dentistry in Kansas. WSU officials are planning to ask Kansas lawmakers for a $5 million feasibility study to explore how a dental school would fit in at Wichita State. The chief of staff of the university said during a town hall meeting today that WSU already has an established program in dental hygiene and a postdoctoral program for dentists. You're listening to KPR. The time is 5:35.
On a Tuesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. More than 50 million people have already cast ballots in this year's election. This continues a long-term trend of people choosing to vote early when offered. So, is there anything this early voting data can tell us, or is it too early to draw any meaningful conclusions about the election? Well, NPR's Ashley Lopez has some answers and joins us now. Hey, Ashley.
Hey there.
Okay, so what can you tell us so far about these 50 million voters who've already cast their ballots?
Yeah, so, I mean, well, early voting is just a slice of the electorate, right? And different states provide different information about who has voted early. But what we do know is this. One, this is a mix of people who have voted early in person and by mail. And two, many of these early voters are people who had their minds made up, probably months ago, and were likely excited to vote as early as possible. And of course, this election could be decided by those lower propensity voters who are making up their mind closer to Election Day.
Right.
And we just don't know how big that pool of voters is yet, or of course, who they will vote for.
Okay. Well, what about how people are voting? Is it more in person or by mail? What do the numbers say about that?
Well, voting methods are a little different compared to 4 years ago. As everyone remembers, 2020 was a weird year for voting because there was a pandemic. So
right.
Many states opened up access to mail voting just for that election, and many voters took advantage of that. This year, depending where you live, access to mail-in voting might have increased or decreased. But overall, fewer voters were always expected to vote by mail compared to 4 years ago. So we have seen a shift somewhat away from mail voting to an in-person early voting.
So I'm thinking many people looking at these numbers might be wondering what it means for their preferred candidate. Yeah. Like, what can you tell us about the party breakdown here?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the first few days of early voting, we did see a higher turnout among Republican voters voting early in person compared to the last presidential election. Mm-hmm. Historically speaking, conservative voters tighter in elections, largely on election day. So this is a pretty significant shift in voting patterns that, you know, may be attributed to a push from Republican Party leaders to get their voters to vote earlier.
Okay, so a shift earlier among some Republicans. What about Democrats?
You know, I should say all this early voting data comes from Michael McDonald at the University of Florida. And I talked to him and he said, while Democratic turnout started a little lower, it is picking up in these later early voting days.
If the past is a guide, and I think in some ways it can be, we know that in this coming week, we're going to see more younger voters, more voters who don't necessarily affiliate with a political party, and more diverse voters.
And of course, the voters he's talking about there tend to lean towards the Democratic coalition, although lately young men and men of color have been shifting a bit more towards the Republican Party lately.
Okay, so we're talking about data on party preferences, but I am curious, like, what about gender? Because isn't gender expected to be a key divide in this election?
Yeah, so it's going to be a while before we get complete demographic data. That always takes a while. But from the information we do have, there is a somewhat larger share of women who have voted early so far. McDonald told me this isn't surprising, though, because women tend to vote earlier. But he says he expects to see men vote in higher numbers on election day, which is similar to past elections. And I just want to make a finer point about this early voting data. As mm-hmm. Michael McDonald pointed out, a lot can change from here until election day. This snapshot we are getting in early voting is not necessarily what the electorate is going to look like when voting ends.
That is NPR's Ashley Lopez. Thank you, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you.
Subscribers keep deserting The Washington Post after it announced it would not endorse any candidate in the race for the White House. NPR's David Folkenflik reported yesterday that the paper had lost 200,000 digital subscribers since the announcement on Friday. Well, today, that figure stands at more than 250,000. Hey, David.
Hey, Mary Louise.
How big a problem does the Washington Post have on its hands here?
This is, you know, pretty much perceived by everybody I've talked to in the Post as something that will go down as a historic moment, a kind of debacle. The numbers that I reported came from two people with direct knowledge. I must say I've gone to the Post a number of times to give them a chance to shoot it down. They have not done so. They said we're a privately held company and we're not going to give out that figure publicly. But that would be about 10% of their paid subscribers, all digital and paper paid subscribers right now. It's something of a calamity for them. It's a collapse of many millions of dollars in revenue, although not all cancellations take effect instantaneously. This afternoon, not very long ago, Matt Murray, the executive editor of the Washington Post, had an all-staff meeting with his newsroom of hundreds of journalists and was pressed on this question a number of times. He said he didn't know the figures and didn't really want to know them, and he specifically didn't want to know them in part because he thought they would leak out.
Now, I will note that the Post is not the only paper doing this. The LA Times announced a similar decision last week to withhold an endorsement. Is what's happening at the Post so different?
Well, it's not so different from what happened at the L.A. Times, which, you know, led to a series of resignations and outcries, some cancellations there. Semaphore reported 18,000 cancellations. I've gotten about 10,000, but nothing on the scale of 250,000 cancellations, right? You know, you've also had other newspapers announce this. For example, the Minnesota Star Tribune announced this back in August. Some papers announced this in recent years as a general practice. To do it right now, right before the election, in a razor's edge election on a race where the Washington Post's own editorial page, sanctioned by its publisher and its ownership, before now, calling former President Trump essentially a perilous threat to the American Democratic experiment, to say right now, a few days ahead of time, hey, we're, you know, even Stephen, you decide for yourself, folks, really seems something of a betrayal to a lot of their readers, clearly, and subscribers. And let's remember, this isn't just any big paper. This is the paper in the nation's capital, the paper of Watergate, the paper of the Pentagon Papers, the paper that embraced the motto, democracy dies in darkness. And a lot of people are ruining it and saying sometimes it dies in sunlight right in front of us.
Well, yesterday, Jeff Bezos came out and took responsibility for this. Bezos, the owner of the Post and, of course, also the founder of Amazon, had an essay in the Post in which he explained the decision not to endorse and said, look, this is a time of historic distrust in the media and endorsement would fester perception of bias. From what you can tell through your reporting, is the staff of the Post buying that reasoning?
They're finding it very hard to swallow. You know, he's looking at the fact that we are at a time of historic lows, as you say, of trust in the media. But had this been done, early this year when the new publisher, Will Lewis, took over, or next year after the elections and a new president took over, it would be viewed very differently. The staff, you know, posted their own dissents online in a column embraced by about 19 of his opinion editors. Several people resigned from the staff entirely, a couple stepped down from the editorial board. And they point to Bezos's myriad business interests that you've mentioned. Many of them have myriad multi-billion dollar questions before the federal government, which may once again be run by Trump.
So for people listening who are mad at the paper, who are thinking of joining that growing number of people canceling their subscriptions, what's the counterargument?
The counterargument is that people presumably subscribed because they wanted the kinds of accountability journalism that the Washington Post provided. Their cancellations will hurt the financial resources that are there for them to do it.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thank you for your reporting.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you are listening to NPR News on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Laura Lorson. Southwest Kansas has the highest concentration of Latino residents in the state, but the area also has some of the lowest rates of people registered to vote. They also have a low rate of voter turnout. Young Latinos there are going back to the basics to try to get their communities more involved in politics. Kaylin Moore filed this report for the Kansas News Service.
There's a bubblegum pink building in the middle of Liberal, Kansas. It's a popular local Mexican restaurant, Chicas Fresas. They specialize in traditional Mexican cooking and sweet treats. It's a Sunday evening and young families are starting to file in. Kathleen Alonso sits by the door in the pink glow of the decorations, but not as a customer.
Are you registered to vote?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
She's there to try to get her community members registered to vote. Southwest Kansas towns are predominantly Latino. Seward County, for example, is almost 70% Latino, and more than 80% of the county has citizenship and are eligible to vote. But that hasn't translated politically. Latinos are still underrepresented in local governments and have some of the lowest rates of voter registration and turnout. Alonzo is an activist for New Frontiers, a subgroup of the voting advocacy group Loudlight.
There's just a large gap of information in the community. I think it's the real reason why I want to push to, number one, engage people, but also inform people.
In the county that includes her hometown of Liberal, 1 in 5 adults are not registered to vote, and voter turnout is well below most of the other Kansas counties. Alonzo believes this stems from disempowerment, a lack of education, and resources. How do you reach those people? You go to places like popular restaurants. Alonzo and other Latin American women have had to get creative to target their communities. Knocking on doors, setting up booths at restaurants, and going to nightclubs are ways she has tried to reach her peers. She also teaches a nighttime citizenship class through the local community college.
Essentially, we just, I think, have to meet people where they are.
Citlali Reyes, who works at the restaurant Chicas Fresas, has seen this firsthand. She also works for the Kansas Latino Community Network, a nonpartisan group where she tries to mobilize voters in Southwest Kansas. But despite that, Reyes herself cannot vote. She has a visa that allows her legally to stay in the country, but not as an official citizen yet. She says that when her community votes, they give people like her a voice.
It's not just the voting of who's going to be our president. It's about the resources that our town will get. So it gets very, very annoying, especially like the people that can vote and won't vote. I'm just like, ugh.
But some people are determined to vote. Emilio Dominguez is 42 years old and works at National Beef. This year, he will get to vote for the first time.
I have the responsibility as a citizen now, to be able to decide who will represent me.
This type of activism by Latinas is not new to Western Kansas. Lena Mose-Vargas, a graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, wrote her dissertation on Latina activism in Kansas. She says the efforts seen by Southwest Kansans today remind her of the Chicano movements of the 1960s and 70s, which Western Kansas actually played a role in.
These everyday Latinas who are doing significant political work, but are not quite recognized as such because they're not as much in the public eye.
From Mexican-American women conferences to being the first to gather data on immigrant needs in Western Kansas, Mose-Vargas says Latinas in rural areas were an overlooked force in advancing the Chicano movement in Kansas. Latino activists in Southwest Kansas today share the same mentality. Alejandra Rangel Lopez with New Frontiers in Dodge City says the group partnered with the Voter Network in Kansas so they can pay everyday Kansans to go out and contact as many community members as possible.
Many folks grew up with folks with mixed status families, right, where you just have to kind of hide and live, what is it, live and die in the shadows, right? And now we're finding out, oh, we don't have to live in the shadows.
In these small towns, it only takes a couple hundred votes to flip a local election. And that's what Rangel Lopez and the other activists echoed, that their communities can have an impact locally. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Kaylin Moore in Liberal.
The Kansas News Service is a collaboration of Kansas Public Radio, High Plains Public Radio, KCUR and KMUW, reporting on health, education, and many other issues, all connected to public policy. For more stories like this one, visit our webpage, kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Spider Art Constructors, offering foundation repair for leaky basements, cracks, leaning walls, and waterproofing as part of your home preservation project. More information at spiderartconstructors.com.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 90.3 FM in Chanute, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello. Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu.
Stay tuned. Coming up in our next half hour, Israel's parliament has moved to limit the work of the main UN agency providing assistance to Palestinians. We will look into that with Kat Lonsdorf. We'll also learn more about the rash of ransomware attacks taking place on healthcare organizations. All of that and more in our final hour of All Things Considered this evening. It is 82 degrees in Lawrence at 10 minutes before 6.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Jewish voters have been a reliable voting bloc for Democrats for decades, but the war between Israel and Hamas has complicated that relationship. Vice President Kamala Harris has faced pressure from progressives in her party to cut off military aid to Israel. At a Harris campaign event yesterday in Pittsburgh, Second Gentleman Doug Imhoff reiterated her commitment to supporting Israel and fighting anti-Semitism.
She will continue to stand with Israel and with the Jewish community, our community. She will reject anti-Semitic hate and the notion that Israel does not have the right to exist.
Meanwhile, some Republicans see an opportunity to win over Jewish voters in key states. NPR's Sarah McCammon reports from suburban Detroit.
For many Jewish Americans, this is a high-stakes election, both for the United States and for the Jewish state.
Israel is in literally the fight for its existence.
Norm Coleman is a former U.S. senator from Minnesota and now national chairman of the Republican Jewish Coalition, or RJC.
The existence of the Jewish state is at risk today, both in terms of war and battle, as well as what happens in the United States in terms of whether our support is there unequivocally or whether folks are going to step back.
At a country club in Bloomfield Township outside Detroit yesterday, Coleman addressed a room full of RJC supporters. Some wore red kippahs, a symbol of their Judaism, with the word Trump printed on one side. Sheila Weissman from nearby West Bloomfield stood outside the event clutching several yard signs, including one that read, Kamala, Oy Vey.
It's been a tepid response at best by this administration.
As a swing state voter, Weissman says she's concerned about war in the Middle East and anti-Semitism at home. a report released by the Anti-Defamation League, using an expanded definition of anti-Semitism to include some anti-Zionist language, found a record number of those types of incidents in the year since the Hamas attacks, including thousands surrounding left-wing anti-Israel demonstrations. Weissman thinks those realities could reshape voting patterns among Jewish Americans who've historically sided overwhelmingly with Democrats and who make up sizable populations in some key states.
I mean, October 7th changed things, and the things that happened in this country on college campuses, I mean, it was just really terrifying. It's infiltrated everywhere.
Weissman has heard the claims that former President Donald Trump has condoned anti-Semitic rhetoric, but she thinks his words are sometimes taken out of context. And she liked his record on Israel, including his decision to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. Jeremy Moss, a Democratic state senator from the area who's himself Jewish, says Jewish voters are concerned about anti-Semitism across the political spectrum, but he believes they ultimately will support the Democratic nominee, as most have in the past.
Kamala Harris has held the line against these extreme voices that spout off anti-Semitism when discussing this Israel conflict on the far left.
Harris has repeatedly said she believes Israel has a right to defend itself from threats across the region and has called for bringing Israeli hostages home and protecting Palestinian civilians.
But then you look at the other side, and Donald Trump platforms anti-Semitic extremism in the Republican Party on the far right.
Moss says most Jewish voters also align with Harris on other key issues, including abortion rights, a major focus of the Democrats' closing message to voters across the country. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Bloomfield Township, Michigan.
Orange County in Southern California is doing something unusual to help with the scarcity of fresh water there. They're putting clean, recycled water into the ground. See, rivers run low in the summer, and there's not a lot of rain. And as water sources get less predictable across the country because of climate change, the OC strategy is inspiring other water districts to follow suit. NPR's Ping Wong went to see how it's done.
If you drive far enough down a dirt road in Anaheim, you'll come to this, a man-made waterfall tucked behind a brewery and some factories.
Right now we're looking at a waterfall. It's about 40 million gallons a day, and it's nice to catch a little mist off the waterfall. It's nice to be cool.
Ben Smith directs recharge operations at the Orange County Water District. It built this waterfall and the big man-made lake below it.
So we're at the La Palma Basin. This is our dedicated recharge basin for the groundwater replenishment system, the recycled sewage water, highly purified.
The water is so clear it looks tropical. Smith says it's the visible part of a large-scale project to create a steady source of drinking water for the region.
It percolates. It goes down through the soil. It will spend several months traveling slowly through the aquifer until it reaches a production well where a city or a water agency will pump it out of the ground and serve it to the homes and businesses.
The lake's headwater is a water purification plant 20 miles to the south. It's at the Orange County Water District headquarters, where Jason Dadakis is an executive director.
In terms of production capacity, this is the largest water recycling facility of its kind.
Dadakis took me on a factory tour. The plant starts with treated wastewater, which would otherwise get dumped in the ocean. It filters it, disinfects it, and ultimately reclaims about 85% of it as clean, drinkable water.
We do offer all of our tour guests the opportunity to taste the water at the end of the tour.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
It tastes like water. It's lukewarm. It doesn't taste like a lot.
That cleaned, recycled wastewater gets piped to the lake in Anaheim and a few others like it. It fills the water needs for a million residents a year. This project started in Orange County more than 15 years ago, and Michael Kiparski at the Wheeler Water Institute at Berkeley Law says they were real pioneers.
I would say that the OC is the OG of this kind of recharge project.
One of the first and the largest and the most well-known among water people.
It takes advantage of the problem that we've made. In many cases, we have mismanaged groundwater resources. And the result of that is that often you have aquifers that have space in them.
When too much groundwater is lost, it can leave gaps underground that collapse and cause sinkholes. Or in areas along the coast, they can fill with seawater and make the groundwater undrinkable. So reclaimed water seems like a win. Why doesn't everyone do it? I asked Sharon Magdahl, director of the Water Resources Research Center at the University of Arizona.
This is not a simple undertaking, because not only are there the geology and kind of physical aspects of the water table, the aquifers and the like, but there are also water quality implications.
Magdahl says it's a huge natural experiment that depends on the soil and bedrock of a specific place. It can change the water chemistry underground and risk pollution from natural arsenic or leach fertilizers and industrial chemicals. And it's also quite expensive. Orange County has spent more than $900 million over 20 years on this project as climate change causes water sources to shift. It's the type of project a lot more places are considering. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Information about the wonders of the universe is at templeton.org. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
The 12-step program for Alcoholics Anonymous resembles the process for Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. Hear more on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations. The latest national, international, and regional news. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, K210CR Atchison 89.9, K258BT Manhattan 99.5, and at kansaspublicradio.org. It's 6 o'clock.
It's a place that certainly, we believe, helps crystallize the choice in this election.
1 week before the election, Vice President Harris chooses to speak from the same spot where former President Trump spoke on January 6, 2021.
For Tuesday, October 29th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A new report from Microsoft says hackers are endangering the lives of patients at hospitals across the U.S.
Healthcare and hospitals are a target that threat actors love because they have an urgency around getting back up and running.
Speaking of hackers, they attack the Internet Archive, which stores so much of what happens on the Internet.
It has unique collections of the World Wide Web and also books, music, video, television.
And the CDC says one type of walking pneumonia is surging in the U.S.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Former President Donald Trump is defending his Madison Square Garden rally, though anything the candidate had to say that night has been eclipsed by the rude and racist remarks made by his opening speakers. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump called it a love fest.
Speaking at his resort in Palm Beach, Florida, former President Donald Trump said it was his honor to be involved in the controversial rally that has consumed his campaign the last several days.
I don't think anybody has ever seen anything like what happened the other night at Madison Square Garden. The love in that room.
Trump's remarks aside, just a week from the final day of voting, his campaign has been playing cleanup after a comedian, warming up the crowd at Trump's Madison Square Garden rally, called Puerto Rico a, quote, floating island of garbage, drawing outrage from the Puerto Rican community and possibly boosting support for Harris's message. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, Palm Beach, Florida.
Trump is holding a campaign event in Pennsylvania tonight. Amid all the focus on the presidential candidates, it's worth mentioning there are important Senate and House races and gubernatorial contests going on. On the Senate side, NPR's Deidre Walsh says Democrats may very well lose their razor-thin majority there.
It's a very tough map this year for Democrats, and right now, Republicans appear to have the edge to pick up enough seats to win control. They're expected to win a seat in West Virginia, where Joe Manchin's retiring, and are in good shape in Montana, where it's a solidly red state, where Democratic Senator John Tester has been trailing his Republican challenger. Democrats are just defending more seats in purple states than Republicans are.
NPR's Deidre Walsh. There could also be Supreme Court vacancies, with a couple of conservative justices expected to retire. Apple is rolling out its new mobile software, iOS 18, and for the first time, it will include generative AI features. NPR's Derek Kerr reports the tech giant has played catch-up with other major companies when it comes to artificial intelligence.
Google, Microsoft, and Facebook all have generative AI chatbots in their products. Apple has been slower to release this technology, but now people with the newest iPhones and iPads will see Apple's latest feature when they update their devices to iOS 18. This feature is called Apple Intelligence, and it wires generative AI into those mobile devices. The AI offers people writing tools and article summaries. It's also being integrated into the virtual assistant Siri. Apple says Siri will now be more conversational and natural. The company's Mac computers are also getting an Apple Intelligence update for the first time. Apple is set to report earnings later this week. Dara Kerr, NPR News.
The mix closed on Wall Street today with continued strength in the tech sector. The NASDAQ rose 145 points. You're listening to NPR. A longtime ally of former President Donald Trump, political strategist Steve Bannon, is free from prison. Bannon released today after serving a four-month sentence for defying a subpoena at the congressional investigation into the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6. Bannon left the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut this morning. Picking up his podcast, Bannon said he'll focus on helping Trump win back the presidency. A jury convicted Bannon of refusing to provide documents related to his involvement in Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. For the first time in months, Shaboozy's A Bar Song is not the number one song in the nation. NPR's Stephen Thompson has the report.
After a 15-week run, A Bar Song, Tipsy, has been replaced at the top of the Billboard Hot 100. Making its debut at number one is Love Somebody by the country star Morgan Wallen.
Who won't leave a hole in my heart?
There's one other new song in this week's top 10. Rosé debuts at number 8 with A Pâté. It's a duet with the singer Bruno Mars. Rosé, who's best known as a member of the group Blackpink, is the first female K-pop singer ever to land a song in the U.S. top 10. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices fell further today amid continued signs of Mideast tensions ratcheting down a bit. Oil had been creeping higher in worries of a widening crisis there. Fell 17 cents a barrel to $67.21 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness, with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Maselli's, now hosting events from 25 to 400 at an expanded downtown location, offering both full-service wedding event planning and hosting, as well as catering to weddings off-site. Venue information online at Maselli's.com.
It's 81 degrees in Lawrence, 83 in Topeka. It is 6:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Tonight, at the historic park that connects the White House to the National Mall, Vice President Harris is delivering what her campaign describes as her closing argument. This is the same spot where her opponent, former President Trump, spoke on January 6, 2021, ahead of the attack on the U.S. Capitol. NPR's Asma Khalid joins us now for more on what to expect. Hi, Asma.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so let's just start with the location of this speech. Explain the choice of this symbolic spot.
Well, it is certainly a deliberate choice to highlight the contrast in this election cycle and, you know, remind voters how the former president tried to overturn the election results in 2020. Mm-hmm. This is the same spot where Trump urged his supporters to march on the Capitol as Congress was certifying the results of that 2020 presidential election. Here's what Harris campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon told reporters on a call today.
It's a place that certainly we believe helps crystallize the choice in this election between a candidate seeking unchecked power in Donald Trump and another that's really offering real solutions to chart a new way forward.
And she said the backdrop of the White House is significant. You know, the Harris campaign has really been trying to zero in on Trump and the threats that they see him pose to democracy. Tonight, according to excerpts of the speech, Harris will describe Trump as someone who is, quote, unstable, obsessed with revenge, and consumed with grievance. Some Democrats worry that people have forgotten what the Trump presidency was like, and so the campaign wants to put the most extreme things he did front and center.
Okay. Well, would you say that this idea that Trump is a danger to democracy is pretty much the central message of Harris's campaign in these final days?
I mean, it's central, but it's not the only message. You know, I have been struck by it, though, because it really does echo the message that we heard from Joe Biden that he was pitching when he was running for president. At the start of Harris's campaign, her main message was freedom, you know, freedom for women to make their own choices about their bodies.
Right.
She still talks about women's reproductive rights. You know, you saw that the other night with Michelle Obama.
Right. So then why did she shift to this Trump democracy message?
I mean, this is a tight race, and the Harris campaign knows that they need to win over moderate voters, and they think this is an issue where they could be persuaded. You know, so you've seen her campaign with some Republicans like former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, and mm-hmm. she also plays up comments from Trump where he referred to his political opponents as the enemy from within. And then, of course, there were the comments from Trump's former chief of staff saying that the former president meets the definition of a fascist. The campaign is focused in these final days of trying to reach that tiny, tiny sliver of still undecided voters, and they see tonight's big symbolic event as a way to potentially break through to them.
Okay. Well, besides focusing on the former president, what else will Harris get into in her speech, you think?
You know, one thing I want to mention to you, Elsa, is that I've spent some time talking to progressive voters on the left of the Democratic Party, and they have told me that they wish Harris would focus a little bit less on Trump and more on her own plans, specifically the economy. The Harris campaign did say that this speech tonight will not only be about Trump. She also intends to talk about issues that matter to middle-class families, like the cost of groceries and housing, and she'll also pledge tonight to listen to people who disagree with her.
Okay, well, I understand that Trump has been trying to get ahead of Harris's remarks today. What did he have to say?
He did not talk about January 6th directly. Instead, you know, he focused on his main campaign issue, which is immigration. And he blamed Harris for the problems with border security and accused her of running a, quote, campaign of hate. You know, Trump is dealing with backlash after his own event recently where he gave his closing arguments and a comedian at that event made disparaging comments about Puerto Rico and more broadly Latinos. Trump did not address that today at his event. His campaign has been trying to appeal more to Latino voters. And tonight, around the same time that Harris will be speaking, the former president is scheduled to give remarks of his own in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I do want to point out that is a former steel town where a majority of the population is Latino.
That is NPR's Asma Khalid. Thank you so much, Asma.
Good to speak with you.
Who preserves what happens on the internet? Well, one answer can be found in an old church in San Francisco, which is home to the Internet Archive. That's a nonprofit with a bigger digital collection than the Library of Congress. The archive holds a record of billions of web pages on its servers. This month, it was attacked by hackers. It was offline for days, prompting a question, what would get lost if the Internet Archive is no more? Brewster Kahle is the founder of Internet Archive, and he's on the line now from San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mary Louise.
So I just checked. Your site looks like it's up and running. It's online. Is everything back and fully restored?
It's not fully restored, but the basic services of archive.org and the Wayback Machine, yes, our library is back, which is
the Wayback Machine, really just to wonderful. Inject, this is the archival service for your website.
Yes, yes. That's where we collect web pages by working with 1,300 libraries, and then we make a service, a free service, to make it so you could see the web as it was.
So can you just describe what these last couple of weeks have looked like for you as you've tried to get the website back online and keep it up and running?
Oh, it's been so hard. Basically, we needed to upgrade our security significantly because basically somebody was able to deface our website. There was no damage to the data, which is great, but they did get our usernames and email addresses of patrons of the Internet Archive. So people's passwords continued to be safe because they were all encrypted. But the list of email addresses doesn't help the spam problem out there.
Yeah. So why would hackers target you?
We don't know, but we're not the only ones. So yes, we were targeted with cyber attacks, but also Calgary Public Library got hit, and they're still offline. Seattle Public Library System was attacked, and they're mostly back up. Toronto Public Library, and the big one was British Library, was attacked a year ago, and still some of their services aren't back up.
There's no ransom that's been demanded, nothing
no,
like that.
No, there hasn't been that. It's mostly been embarrassing. So we have gotten the message, and we're addressing putting in more and better firewalls and code sanitization to go and make sure that the services stay up as people are expecting.
Yeah. There's obviously a rich irony here for a site dedicated to preserving activity on the internet potentially being wiped off the internet. What would be lost if a cyber attack had actually succeeded at damaging your site permanently?
Well, if the Internet Archive were to go away, it has unique collections of the World Wide Web and also books, music, video, television, for decades of television. It's a full-fledged library. So the idea of losing the Internet Archive is not just the web collection, but it would be a whole lot more.
What you're describing, Mr. Kale, is such a huge responsibility, protecting all of this information. Are you confident you can do it?
We'll do everything we can. It's part of the job. We have preservation and access as sort of tattooed into our souls. So preservation, to go and make sure that the information that's that we've collected stays, and then can we make it as accessible as possible? We first wanted to make sure that our preservation function was in good shape, which we did, and then we worked very hard to try to get the access back up. But we're just seeing attacks on libraries from many different angles, and this is just another one.
That is Brewster Kale, digital librarian and founder of the Internet Archive. Thank you.
Thank you.
The deadliest Israeli airstrike in weeks happened in northern Gaza overnight. More than 70 Palestinians were killed, at least 25 of whom were children. And more are missing, according to the Ministry of Health. It comes as Israel's parliament voted to ban the main UN agency for aid in Gaza. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, and a warning, this story describes graphic scenes of war.
Freelance photojournalist Islam Ahmed was just two streets away when an Israeli airstrike hit a five-story building full of displaced Palestinian families in the northern neighborhood of Beit Lehia. He hurried to the scene. I saw human parts and dead bodies in the streets, Ahmed told NPR in a voice note. Ahmed says he also saw bodies trapped under the rubble, and that he and other civilians tried to pull them out, but he couldn't reach them because the rubble was too heavy and they didn't have tools. Last week, the Israeli military demanded the Gaza civil defense teams leave the area, meaning the usual first responders were not there. We used our bare hands, Ahmed says. These were not the hands of paramedics or well-trained people, he says. It was the hands of us, their neighbors. northern Gaza, and specifically Beit Lahia, has been besieged by the Israeli military for weeks. No ambulances or vehicles could get in or out. So people were carrying the wounded to the nearest hospital on their backs or using donkey carts, hospital officials told NPR. But Israeli forces raided that hospital over the weekend, saying that Hamas was operating from it. They destroyed much of it and detained many of the staff. Hospital officials say their ability to treat the wounded is limited and the morgue is not functioning. The dead from today's strike were buried in the streets. The Israeli military did not give a reason for the strike, but said it was, quote, looking into the incident. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, Israel's parliament passed legislation banning operations for UNRWA, the United Nations' main aid agency for Palestinians. Israel says the agency has ties to Hamas, and some staffers took part in the October attack last year that sparked this current war. But many say UNRWA is essential for life-saving operations on the ground in Gaza. Here's Kate Phillips-Barrasso from the aid group Mercy Corps.
This could potentially be a final knockout blow to the humanitarian response, certainly in Gaza,
where humanitarian needs are dire. And Phillips-Barrasso says UNRWA can't simply be replaced. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence. Also at 91.3 FM in Junction City. Always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center of JCCC, presenting What If Puppets in Shiver Me Paintbrush, A Pirate's Adventure in Art, December 6th and 7th, created with a neurodivergent audience in mind. More at jccc.edu/mtc.
Thanks so much for making KPR a part of your day. Coming up in our next 30 minutes, an update of news headlines. Talk about a newly discovered Mayan city. They discovered it through the use of data mining. We'll also hear commentary from Rex Buchanan talking about renewable energy. And we'll get you the details on what we know about fires that were set at ballot drop boxes in and near Portland, Oregon. Those stories and more still to come. Stay tuned.
Support for KPR comes from Kansas Health Foundation, empowering Kansans to collaborate on a variety of challenges to make the state a healthier place to live. Ways to engage are at kansashealth.org.
Following All Things Considered this evening on your KPR One stations, it's classical music with Destiny, focusing on ghosts. Tonight, The Girl in the Tower, The Gray Lady, many more. Also some Liszt coming up tonight and some Haydn. If you're joining us on KPR2, stick around at 7 o'clock for Reveal. We do have a wind advisory in effect for the entire KPR listening area through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, expecting severe weather to roll in late tomorrow afternoon into tomorrow evening. It's 81 degrees in Lawrence, 83 in Topeka. It is 620.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 4 years ago, President Biden won Pennsylvania by less than 2 percentage points. Included in his winning coalition were young voters who sided with him by a 27-point margin. Well, this year, Vice President Harris's campaign is trying to nail down those voters again, heading to both the blue cities and suburbs and small towns and rural areas that are places for former President Trump handily won. NPR's Elena Moore takes us to a small town an hour outside Pittsburgh to hear from young students about how they see their voting power.
Indiana, Pennsylvania has some big titles. Some call it the Christmas tree capital of the world, and it just so happens to be the birthplace of actor Jimmy Stewart. I'm standing in front of a statue of him outside the town courthouse. But it's not quite Christmas time yet. It is almost November. And nearby, at the Indiana University of Pennsylvania's campus, some locals want to give this place another title.
The road to the White House goes through Indiana County, Pennsylvania.
Local Democratic Party Chair Lynn Alvin is watching as student organizers set up for a Get Out the Vote rally. And while this campus may be part of a tiny blue dot, it lives within a red county that went for Trump last time by 37 points. But Alvin understands that. The goal is to narrow the margins.
Our motto is lose by less. We don't imagine that we can win the vote for Harris in Indiana County, but we can bring out enough Democratic votes.
I think we bring the energy to counties like this.
IUP student Andrew Muth runs the school's College Democrats. As somebody from a rural area less than an hour away, he knows why voters here feel left behind. But he says Harris has a message that can connect with locals.
We want you to be able to build a family. We want you to be able to afford your groceries. We want you to be able to afford housing.
Local Republicans, though, aren't worried about the margins, even with the student vote.
You know, a lot of those students are not students from Indiana County. They're outsiders.
That's 24-year-old Hunter Overdorf. He's with the local GOP, and he grew up here. Still, the Harris campaign is working hard in rural areas of Pennsylvania. They have 50 offices in the state coordinated with the Democratic Party, 16 of those in counties that Trump won by double digits in 2020. Those past margins are why the Trump campaign isn't worried.
Reaching out to voters and canvassing them is important, but that only works when you have a winning candidate and a winning message.
That's Kush Desai, the Pennsylvania Communications Director for the Trump campaign.
The issues that we're running on, if anything, have a greater salience in rural Pennsylvania and rural America writ large.
Those issues, the economy and immigration. At a coffee shop on IUP's campus, those are the topics shaping 22-year-old grad student Keely McElveen's vote.
I'm going to vote for Trump and Vance. It's kind of the philosophy of voting for the lesser of two evils amongst the parties.
She's from the county over and commutes to school, so things like gas prices are a concern. And to her, Harris hasn't acknowledged the mistakes of the last 4 years and how she'll be different.
That's kind of pulled me away from her in a sense. I will say Trump could be a better communicator just because he's very loud, which polarizes our people. However, he is very clear on what he stands for. That speaks volumes.
Back at the rally, other students continue to side with Harris, in large part over social issues, which are key to her campaign's message.
I'm always an advocate for someone having their own right to their body and who they love and what medical decisions they should make.
20-year-old Samaya Settles is from a town outside Pittsburgh, but she plans to vote on campus. She was much more excited to have Harris as the Democratic nominee than President Biden, and thinks that energy remains for other young people.
I would say I still feel that, and I think it is because of her age. She really does know how to connect with the young people. She just feels like she is us.
And in just 1 week, we'll see how many other young people feel the same. Elena Moore, NPR News, Indiana, Pennsylvania.
So if you or your kid has a cough that's been lingering, you may want to listen closely to this next story. The CDC says cases of a type of walking pneumonia are surging across the U.S., especially among young kids. NPR health correspondent Maria Godoy has more.
Dr. Preeti Sharma is a pediatric pulmonologist at UT Southwestern and Children's Health in Dallas. She's also a mom of two. At the end of May, her 12-year-old daughter came home from school with what looked like a typical summer cold.
She had a runny nose, some sneezing, a little bit of sore throat, and a little bit of kind of feeling fatigued, lower appetite.
And then the cough started.
We just kind of watched it progress until she had this very lingering, deep, disruptive cough.
That cough is what tipped Sharma off that her daughter had mycoplasma pneumonia. It's caused by a bacterial infection. The CDC says cases began rising across the U.S. in the spring and summer, and that surge has continued into fall. Sharma says in Dallas, they saw a big spike after kids went back to school.
Kids are spreading it to one another in schools, and they are likely bringing it home to their parents and families as well.
This pneumonia usually manifests with upper respiratory symptoms, though some kids can also develop red eyes or rashes. Dr. Caleb Ward is with Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C., which has seen a tenfold increase in cases this year. He says the good news is many cases tend to be mild, hence the term walking pneumonia.
Folks historically may have been going to school, going to work, assumed they just had a kind of mild cold virus, and in fact had mycoplasma pneumonia.
New York City has also seen a jump in cases. Dr. Adam Ratner is an infectious disease specialist at NYU and Hassenfeld Children's Hospital. He says mycoplasma pneumonia is usually seen in kids ages 5 to 17.
That has changed in the last year with this current spike.
He says while the infection is still more common in these older kids,
we're seeing more cases in sort of that 2 to 4-year-old age range. That's being seen nationwide, and it's consistent with what we're seeing here.
Most kids can be treated at home. Just keep them hydrated, give them age-appropriate medicines for their fever as needed, and make sure they get plenty of rest. If a child is over age 1, honey can help ease a cough. As for when to call the doctor, Ratner says use the same judgment you would anytime your kid is sick.
If there's a child who is breathing faster or seems like they're having trouble breathing, they're having more fever, then that's a situation where you probably do want to go to the pediatrician for evaluation.
If a kid needs an antibiotic, they'll likely get a macrolide like azithromycin. That's because amoxicillin, which is the go-to antibiotic for pediatricians, it doesn't work against mycoplasma pneumonia. Here's Dr. Preethi Sharma again.
The good news about mycoplasma is that it is not a new bacteria. It is easily treated with antibiotics. And usually kids feel better fairly readily after the correct antibiotic is started.
Sharma says kids can go back to school once they've been fever-free without the use of fever reducers for at least 24 hours, as long as they feel physically up to it. Just know that symptoms like cough and runny nose can stick around for weeks, and they could potentially still be shedding infectious droplets the whole time. Doctors say that's one reason why outbreaks of mycoplasma pneumonia tend to last a long time. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The 12-step program, made famous by Alcoholics Anonymous, resembles the process for Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous.
Nobody wants to talk about being in fetal position on the bathroom floor because someone didn't call you.
We also have news if you're in the fetal position about the election. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. We will have the latest national, international, and regional news. Jay Schaefer will have the latest on the weather. We are still under a wind advisory through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Support for KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, reminding listeners that dental checkups can help identify health conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and more. Dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find.
News headlines are up next at 6:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, an anthropologist who helped discover a Mayan site built thousands of years ago.
We can now see through the canopy without having to deforest it in real life, right? We can digitally deforest areas and see what's underneath.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. With a week to go until Election Day, former President Donald Trump's using words like love fest to describe his campaign rallies. But as NPR's Stephen Fowler tells us, his speeches at those rallies are getting more erratic and profane.
His rallies have been lower energy, seen more gaffes, and have often started hours late. He's always pushed the envelope of appropriate speech from a politician, but recently he's also become more vulgar in his anecdotes and attacks. Trump sounds more tired and occasionally even melancholy about what might come next.
What we've done, we got to win.
if we don't win, it's like it was all for not very much. We can't let that happen.
At 78, Trump would be the oldest person elected president in the U.S. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
A familiar face from movies of the 1970s and 80s has died. Terry Garr died of complications from multiple sclerosis at her home here in Los Angeles this morning. She was 79 years old. As Tanya Ballard Brown tells us, Garr perfected playing quirky blondes over the course of many decades.
Terry Garr spent the early years of her career dancing in Elvis Presley movies and on the Sonny and Cher show. Many remember her from the movies Young Frankenstein and Mr. Mom, but it was the film Tootsie that earned her an Oscar nomination.
I read The Second Sex. I read The Cinderella Complex. I'm responsible for my own orgasm. I don't care. I just don't like to be lied to.
Garr was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1999. She talked about it a few years later on WHYY's Fresh Air.
I try to make it easier on other people because I always think it's harder on them than it is on me.
The actress became a vocal advocate for MS education and research before her death. Tanya Ballard Brown, NPR News.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street. The Dow lost 154 points, down 0.3%. You're listening to NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. First to the weather, we are in the KPR listening area, all of us under a wind advisory. Through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, that means these gusty winds are going to keep up all night. Gusts up to around 50 miles per hour for most of us. Some areas could see higher gusts at times. Tomorrow, continued breezy, a slight chance of rain in the morning, 50% chance of showers and storms in the afternoon. We are expecting highs in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, actually in that sort of gray area in the evening, is when we could really see some severe weather kicking up through Manhattan, Topeka, Lawrence, all of it moving toward the Kansas City area long after, let's say, 7 o'clock. So you need to have a plan right now to stay weather aware. 70% chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow night. Once all of that weather moves through, it will be much less humid with lows in the lower 40s. We get a bit of a break on Thursday, but starting Friday night, we will see a pattern bringing lots of rain to the area, extending all the way through the middle of next week. Could be a rainy election day, so make sure you stay tuned to KPR. We'll let you know what's coming. Republican members of a committee on medical marijuana say they need more information before recommending a bill to the full Kansas legislature. They voted yesterday not to immediately propose legalizing medical marijuana, but the committee will continue discussing the topic. Democrats like Representative Heather Meyer say lawmakers already know enough to form a basic proposal, pointing to bills that previously advanced but did not become law.
There's been quite a bit of work been done on this issue for several years, definitely before my time.
Some Republicans say they'd be more open to recommending a bill if their questions are addressed at the next hearing in January. Recent polls indicate more than 70% of Kansans support legalizing medical marijuana. Kansas is one of 12 states where it remains illegal. And Wichita State University leaders say Wichita could be a perfect site for the first school of dentistry in Kansas. WSU officials plan to ask Kansas lawmakers for a $5 million feasibility study to explore how a dental school would fit in at Wichita State. University Chief of Staff Zach Gearhart said during a town meeting today that WSU has an established program in dental hygiene and a postdoctoral program for dentists. He says a dental school would be a boon for the state.
Over 70 counties of 105 counties in Kansas are underserved in dental health care. So this is something where Wichita State can leverage its existing capabilities with new investment from the legislature.
Gearhart says building and operating a school of dentistry would cost about $100 million. This is KPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Hackers are putting lives at risk at hundreds of hospitals across the United States. And a new report from tech giant Microsoft says it's only getting worse. NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin reports.
Everything went down and nothing was communicated amongst anyone.
Dina Carlisle is a registered nurse from Michigan.
She's also a union president representing hundreds of nurses who work at Ascension Providence Rochester Hospital.
So May 8th, my people over at Ascension called me and they said, "We think everything just went down. We're not sure."
It was the nightmare scenario. Criminal hackers broke into Ascension Healthcare, a network of over 100 private Catholic hospitals and senior living facilities across the United States. The nurses were in the dark, Carlisle said. In some cases, they couldn't even find their patients in the hospital. For Carlisle, it was clear. Hackers were putting patients' lives in danger.
"We just lived through a pandemic, and it was the worst amount of death I've ever seen. And then to think, what could ever be this bad? You know, it's like, and here it is."
For a healthcare professional to compare the experience of enduring the COVID-19 pandemic to caring for patients during a ransomware attack, Carlisle's story is personal. It's unfortunately one of many. But lately, researchers have also been working to gather hard data to illustrate the impacts of this crisis. The numbers are disturbing. According to a new report from Microsoft, ransomware attacks on healthcare have gone up over 300% since 2015. Here's Shara DeGrippo, the report's author.
Healthcare and hospitals are a target that threat actors love because they have an urgency around getting back up and running. And they tend to have patient care as their number one focus, meaning any time lost is not acceptable.
The report also relies on research from an emergency room doctor, who also happens to be a cybersecurity expert.
You know, we're continuing to see these attacks impact the care of patients. It's increasingly untenable from a national security perspective, and that's something that terrifies me.
Dr. F is at the University of California, San Diego. He co-founded UCSD's Center for Healthcare Cybersecurity. One of the center's biggest findings, a key part of Microsoft's report, is that a ransomware attack impacts healthcare in an entire region. If one hospital is hit, a nearby hospital is suddenly flooded with emergency room patients. Doctors are overloaded and can't always prevent healthcare emergencies like strokes or heart attacks.
As we've recognized this as a human issue, a whether or not patients will survive question, not just whether or not their privacy will be preserved. That's given me hope.
Hope, because DeMaff thinks his community is starting to get their arms around the problem. But mapping its contours isn't easy. According to UC San Diego, 70% of a hospital's digital connections come from medical devices like CT scanners, rather than computers, creating a complex web of vulnerable and critical services. Going forward, it will take a complex web of experts to tackle this problem.
Doctors and nurses and economists and policy folk, you have to bring all those folks to the table to make up the next generation of solutions that are really going to help keep patients safe.
That includes everything from training young doctors and nurses to revert to paper when networks are down, to building a backup system of replacement technology that can be used in a crisis. It's about being more resilient, because at this point, every hospital is a target. Dina Carlisle, the nurse and union president in Michigan, is clear-headed on the stakes.
I think at some time, we're all a patient. We're having babies, grandchildren. Our parents are getting older. It's so important that we make sure this cyber safety is in place so that our patients are safe.
So that all of us patients are safe. Jenna McLaughlin, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
Researchers have discovered a Mayan site hidden deep in the jungle on the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. They've named the site Valeriana, and it's thought to have been built over 1,000 years ago. Surveying an area of 50 square miles, the study revealed more than 6,000 structures, including stone pyramids similar to those found at the most famous sites of Mayan ruins. The dense jungle kept Valeriana hidden from the scientific community, but archaeologists found the settlements with an aerial mapping technology called LIDAR. Marcello Canuto is a professor of anthropology at Tulane University and a co-author on the study. He joins us now. Welcome and congratulations for discovering an ancient Mayan settlement. Yeah?
Thank you very much. And thank you for the invitation.
Of course. So can you just first paint a picture of what Valeriana probably looked like at its height? Like what kind of structures did you find? How was this settlement laid out?
It's just a hilly landscape. And on top of these hills are these large
temples, these large pyramids, and all around would have been other small settlements or other houses. The landscape would be a mosaic of some forest patches, agricultural features, and even roads and or trails. So you could walk from one house to another and then eventually come to the center of the city where there would be maybe a market or where a ball court where they would be playing the rubber ball game, right? And you would go and visit the center for particular economic activities or because of rituals, and then maybe in the afternoon go home.
And just for context, in terms of its size, how would you compare the size of Valeriana compared to other prominent Mayan settlements that have already been discovered?
There are a lot of very famous lowland Maya sites, such as Tikal in Guatemala or Calakmul in Mexico that's nearby, that are these really behemoths. This site isn't that size. These medium-sized sites would have been administrative and religious centers, and very likely also centers where people came and traded.
So the story is it was actually one of your students who discovered this site with data that he found on Google, right?
That's right.
Tell us about how he stumbled on that data, and what was this data that you all eventually analyzed?
So Luke, my PhD student, Luke Al Thomas, had been reading about LIDAR data that had been recently published. And LIDAR, it's basically a pulse of light that's sent from a sensor, and it measures the distance between the sensor and the phenomenon that's bouncing back the light. And so years earlier, a research group had done a LIDAR survey of this area for completely different reasons. It had nothing to do with archaeology. And so we downloaded the data and began to analyze it for archaeological purposes.
Did you ever imagine that your job as an archaeologist and anthropologist would look like this, sifting through mounds and mounds of data on a computer instead of hacking through the jungle with a machete like Indiana Jones?
The answer is unequivocally, no, I never imagined this.
You would rather be Indiana Jones.
Exactly. You're a kid. You're just like, okay, I'm going to go out there and so forth. But I'll tell you this. What's really exciting about this is not that suddenly we just sit in front of computer screens only, right? What the computer screens allow us to do and all the data that we can see allow us to be really efficient in the field. We know where we need to go. We know what we need to see. Whereas before, we would go to the jungle, but we would be always worried that we're missing something,
yeah.
Right? Now we are a little bit more armed with information.
Yeah.
So to a certain extent, I think it makes me want to go there more, right? In other words, I know that I am going to have a really fruitful month or two in the jungle.
Anthropology professor Marcello Canuto of Tulane University, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you are listening to NPR News on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Laura Lorson. Over the past 25 years, wind turbines have been sprouting up all over Kansas. Today, nearly 4,000 of them dot the landscape. About 400 of those are taller than the Statue of Liberty. Now, while much of the nation has embraced this form of renewable energy, commentator Rex Buchanan says we still haven't curbed our appetite for fossil fuels.
Lately, I've been working on a book project that involves revisiting some places in the state, places I last saw about 20 years ago. In that 20 years, some parts of the Kansas landscape haven't really changed all that much, but some have. Maybe the biggest change is related to energy. Just about everywhere you go in the state, you see wind farms. Some of them, like the one near Montezuma in southwestern Kansas, have been around for a long time. Others, like the ones that line I-70 out by Colby, are newer. We've heard a lot about the advent of wind power in Kansas. Kansas is now among the country's leaders in wind generation, producing almost half the electricity used in the state. You've probably seen the maps showing about 40 wind farms scattered across Kansas. But until you see them in person, especially their scale, it's hard to comprehend just how big wind power has become. The wind farm in Ellsworth County lines 24 miles of I-70. And today's turbines are big, much larger than the ones near Montezuma. With all that wind power has come another change in the landscape, new transmission lines. The electricity generated by wind turbines must be carried to where it's needed, and that's made for lots more large-scale transmission lines. According to National Stories, development of new wind generation has slowed across the country. At the same time, solar energy is picking up. People in Douglas County, and many parts of the state for that matter, know about proposals for these new large installations. One's already operating in Stanton County out in far southwestern Kansas. It's about 75,000 panels spread out over 144 acres. A much bigger one is under construction east of Medicine Lodge in Barber County, expected to come online next year. In short, Kansas is contributing mightily to the increased production of renewable energy. But that contribution hasn't come easy. Locating some of these facilities has been and continues to be contentious, to say the least. Yet maybe the statistic that I find most striking is that in spite of all the additional renewable energy production in Kansas and across the country, fossil fuel consumption nationwide hasn't really gone down all that much. On a percentage basis, we still use fossil fuels for roughly 80% of our energy. That's maybe down a little from a few years ago, but not down all that much. Renewables still account for about 20% of the energy we use. While the production of renewable energy goes up, so does the overall amount of energy we use. Renewables can take up the slack, help us satisfying that new demand, but that doesn't necessarily translate to dramatically using less fossil fuel. Now, if you care about climate change, and I can't quite see why you wouldn't, that last statistic about our continued reliance on fossil fuel makes apparent just how hard it'll be to mitigate climate change. We've come a long way when it comes to renewables. Driving across the state makes that clear. But we've still got a long, rough way to go.
Commentator Rex Buchanan is a writer, author, and director emeritus of the Kansas Geological Survey. He lives in Lawrence.
Support for KPR comes from the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting former Congressman Luke Messer and Sherry Bustos for their series Congress in the 21st Century. Wednesday, October 30th, 4 p.m. More at DoleInstitute.org.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence. Also at 96.1 FM in Lawrence, 89.7 FM in Emporia, lots of other frequencies across the state, and always streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
If it's not worth the time or effort to sell that old car, truck, or motorcycle, KPR's vehicle donation program will gladly take it off your hands so we can turn it into the programs you enjoy every day. Donate your vehicle online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Stay with us. We still have about 11 minutes of All Things Considered yet to come. If you're joining us on KPR1 this evening, our show will be followed by news headlines, then Stardate, then 2 hours of classical music with Destiny, continuing with her ghostly, spooky theme for this week. That is followed by Jazz in the Night. If you're joining us on KPR2, stay tuned for Reveal, followed by news from the BBC World Service. Breezy conditions tonight, lows in the upper 60s. We do have a wind advisory for the entire KPR listening area through 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. We are expecting some severe weather tomorrow in the late afternoon through the early evening in the Lawrence, Topeka, Manhattan areas, further into the nighttime hours for the Kansas City Metro. It's 10 minutes before 7.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 50 years ago in Boston, someone threatened to set off a nuclear bomb. It was a hoax, but it led to the creation of a secretive government squad to handle nuclear emergencies. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports on this rarely seen group and what they're up to today.
In an aircraft hangar at Joint Base Andrews, just outside of Washington, D.C., the government's first line of response to nuclear emergencies gathered to celebrate its 50th anniversary. There was cake and drinks and speeches, but right from the start, it was clear this was not an ordinary birthday party.
A quick admin announcement before we go further.
I have to note this is an unclassified event, so please understand that there is a lot that our people are not going to be able to discuss.
This group is known as the Nuclear Emergency Support Team, or NEST, like a bird's nest. The team is mostly made up of people who work elsewhere in government, scientists, federal law enforcement personnel, regulators. They all take time out of their day jobs to prepare for a nuclear incident. Think of it as a volunteer fire department, except the volunteers have high-level security clearances and they respond to nuclear threats.
When it comes to a radiological or nuclear event, NEST's mission at the very core of it is providing that scientific advice about either what has happened or what could happen.
G. Tilden oversaw NEST for several years at the Department of Energy and has written a history of its activities. A lot of what it's done sounds like it belongs in a spy thriller. In 1978, NEST deployed in Canada's remote Northwest Territories to recover debris from a crashed Soviet reconnaissance satellite that was powered by uranium. A year later, NEST helicopters circled over the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant after one of the plant's reactors partially melted down. NEST experts and equipment also went to Fukushima, Japan, after a nuclear power plant there melted down and spewed a plume of radioactivity across the countryside.
It was to help the Japanese government understand what is being released from the damaged reactors and where is that plume going? Where is it depositing on the ground?
That kind of information is critical to determining how to respond to a nuclear incident, who needs to evacuate, for example. Teams also train on how to deal with nuclear dirty bombs and nuclear weapons that are lost or damaged. NEST has always kept a low profile, partially because almost everything it does related to nuclear weapons and nuclear terrorism is classified, but also because it doesn't want to alarm people. At the same time, J. Tilden says they don't want to be seen as a shadowy government agency flying around in black helicopters.
We didn't even want them dark gray because they look like military. We wanted to be very distinct that we're a civil agency, and when those aircraft are flying, they're flying largely for a public health and safety mission.
The helicopters are two-toned blue and gray, and the government agents who fly them around, not men in black, it's folks like Jacqueline Brandon.
When I found out as a scientist I get to fly in a helicopter and do real national security missions, I was like, sign me up right away.
Brandon is a PhD physical chemist who sits in the back scanning for signs of radioactivity as the helicopter flies low to the ground.
To me, it's like a roller coaster ride. I love it.
She's airborne a lot. This year alone, NEST aircraft had flown above the Super Bowl, both Democratic and Republican national conventions. And then there's the events they haven't planned for.
They happen periodically. So.
And what happens for you if there's an on-call event? Like, what's your life like?
Exciting. We'll pack all of our gear up and be in the air in 4 hours, and then flying over whatever we're trying to fly over.
Brandon didn't want to get into too many specifics about what might call a NEST team out, but Wendon Smith, who's the current head of NEST, was willing to talk about it, kind of.
We don't provide the details, but I would say on a weekly basis, there's either an unknown event that triggers the deployment of an NEST team or a question from a local responder.
Smith is at the Energy Department. She says nuclear materials are more part of daily life than most people realize. They're used in oil and gas drilling and in a lot of medical applications. Sometimes people are even injected with radioactive dye to aid with medical imaging. In fact, somebody with radioactive dye in their body might have caused a recent NEST response. After local police found a suspicious puddle in a fast food parking lot somewhere in America. I can neither confirm or deny, but
if someone doesn't use a public restroom and happens to alleviate their need in a parking lot, then that can cause a troubled signature if there is indeed a medical isotope involved.
Hypothetically, if you do get injected with a radioactive isotope as part of a medical scan, Smith asks you use the restroom. Of course, NEST prepares for far worse. They don't want to say what exactly, but they do want you to know that after 50 years, they're still going strong.
The fact that people understand that NEST exists and what its mission is and how successfully we perform it is important to help people sleep at night.
The government's volunteer nuclear fire department stands ready, just in case. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
A series of attacks on ballot drop boxes in the Portland, Oregon area have officials there on high alert. Police say two fires set in ballot boxes on Monday are connected to a third incident. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Dirk Vanderhart reports.
The calls came in rapid succession. At 3:30 a.m. Monday, Portland police were alerted to a fire at a ballot box outside of county election headquarters. A half hour later, police in the neighboring city of Vancouver, Washington, responded to a blaze at a drop box there, this one at a transit center. A local news crew showed up in time to grab footage of officials shoveling smoldering ballots onto a rainy sidewalk. Police say the two fires were set by the same person or people, using a device designed to ignite the paper inside. And they link Monday's fires to a failed October 8th attack on a separate Vancouver ballot box. Mike Benner is a spokesperson for Portland Police.
There was enough evidence collected at all three scenes that lead us to believe that all three incidents are connected.
The damage was limited. In the Portland fire, just three ballots were burned, but possibly hundreds were destroyed in the Washington incident. Election officials say voters who used the box can ask for a replacement ballot. The fires could affect a tight U.S. House race in Southwest Washington. Oregon and Washington have long voted by mail and drop box, and the attacks have rattled election workers like Multnomah County, Oregon Elections Director Tim Scott.
I've been with Multnomah County Elections for 16 years. I've been in elections for 22 years. This is the first time any incident has occurred.
Authorities haven't announced a motive in the incidents. Police are looking for a dark-colored Volvo that may be connected to the fires. The FBI is also investigating. Ballot boxes have been under increasing scrutiny in recent years, says Max Reed. He's a senior research manager for elections at the nonprofit Institute for Strategic Dialogue.
Ballot drop boxes have been subject of conspiracy theories and false claims about their security since 2020. They've been a focus at different times for some extremist groups and other election integrity groups.
In the Portland area, police are stepping up patrols around ballot boxes, and officials like Scott are asking voters to be alert.
Anyone who sees any suspicious activity around a ballot drop site, please reach out, call us, let us know.
But the overarching message from Scott and other officials is simply this: vote. For NPR News, I'm Dirk Vanderhart in Portland.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
The 12-step program for Alcoholics Anonymous resembles the process for Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. Hear more on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. He will have the latest regional news and the very latest on the weather. We are expecting an active weather day tomorrow. Make sure you tune in. It's a great way to start your day. Morning Edition on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Public Library, offering downloadable ebooks, audiobooks, streaming movies, and more, all available with a library card. Card information at lplks.org.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7. KANB and KANB HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Noto Arts and Entertainment District of Topeka, presenting a celebration of souls, Day of the Dead in southern Mexico. Exhibit features photography of the Oaxacan Memorial Holiday, opens October 4th. Information at explorenoto.org.
Mostly cloudy skies tonight. Continued windy. Lows in the upper 60s. We all in the KPR listening area have a wind advisory through 7 a.m. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy. Chance of rain in the morning. Better chance in the afternoon. Excellent chance tomorrow night. Could see some severe weather as well. Lows tomorrow night in the lower 40s. It's 7:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Striding on stage to the chants of USA, USA, Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris is on the National Mall tonight. Harris speaking at the site of the Ellipse where former President Donald Trump held the rally that sparked the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol 4 years ago. And speaking in Washington, D.C. tonight, Harris hoping to make the point she's offering a stark alternative to another Trump presidency.
We know who Donald Trump is. He is the person who stood at this very spot nearly 4 years ago and sent an armed mob to the United States Capitol to overturn the will of the people in a free and fair election.
Harris says she will work to improve their lives while her Republican rival is, quote, unstable and only works to improve his own life while going after his political enemies. In the final week of the campaign, labor unions are blanketing swing states, deploying canvassers to knock on millions of doors. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, some unions say it's working.
Labor unions have poured far more resources into this presidential election than in years past in a bid to get Kamala Harris elected. While the first phase was all about persuasion, Danny Bowder, president of the Philadelphia Council, AFL-CIO, says now,
it's a turnout operation. We're doing everything that we can to make sure that union members turn out and vote.
The United Auto Workers Union says its outreach campaign appears to be working. It notes that in polling, Harris had a 29-point lead among its members who said they'd heard from the UAW about the election. Among those who said they were not contacted, Harris's lead was considerably smaller. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Millions of low-income Americans live in older homes that are falling into disrepair. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports it's making the country's housing shortage even worse.
Velma Fischel's home in western Pennsylvania is more than a century old, and she panicked when she saw the walls separating from the ceiling. The foundation had shifted.
How could I fix it? Yeah, I'm on Social Security.
Local planner Lou Ann Zach says letting disrepair go damages entire communities.
I see more and more vacant houses yearly just being abandoned.
Researchers say a patchwork of repair programs are underfunded with years-long wait lists. A popular Pennsylvania program did not get new funding, but it is touted as a model, including in Congress. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
There's been a great deal of discussion about the economy in this election, and one important segment is consumer confidence. That appears to have rebounded somewhat. The Conference Board says consumer confidence rose more than 9 points this month compared to September. A mixed close on Wall Street, the Dow is down 154 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. This is Kansas Public Radio.
Stardate October 29th. The skies above most cities and towns are glowing. Artificial light sources beam a lot of their light into the sky. That makes it harder to see the heavens, and it can cause health problems, endanger wildlife, and waste both energy and money. One big contributor to the problem is streetlights. They can be improved by adding shielding that directs their light downward and by using the right kind of fixtures. One type of fixture that could help is LEDs. They use less energy than most other types of lighting. They last longer, and their light can be concentrated on the ground, not the sky. As a result, many cities have replaced older street lamps with LEDs. But experts on light pollution have some concerns about those fixtures. Because LEDs are cheaper to operate and last longer than older lamps, some locations may increase the number of street lights, for example. Studies have found that watt for watt, white LEDs produce more sky glow than other types of lighting. And the color of the light can be a problem as well. LEDs produce more intense blue light than some older street lamps. That increases glare, and makes it harder for the eye to adapt when you go from a bright area to a darker one. Experts do suggest, however, that warmer LED fixtures operating at lower levels can light up the ground without making the skies glow even brighter. We have sky-watching tips, astronomy news, and much more about the universe in Stardate magazine. Details at stardate.org. For the McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
Hopefully getting you in the Halloween mood here on KPR. That was Gluck's Dance of the Blessed Spirits with Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra. Happy Tuesday! I am your host, Destiny. Glad you are here with me. Something premiered on this day many moons ago, Mozart's Don Giovanni, and well, I know we've all heard that many a time, but I found something really neat about Don Giovanni that I'm going to share with you at around 7:30. So please, please, please keep listening. Speaking of Halloween, guess what? This Thursday night on Classics Live, we are going to air last year's version of my Halloween show. It's going to be pretty fun. I just did a new Halloween show last Friday. Well, you'll get to hear last year's. Thursday night at 7, it's KPR's Classics Live, and then Tango Thursday after that.
All right. Speaking of this spooky time of year, a favorite of many of you, Stephen McNeff's Ghosts. Yes, this is with John Boyd conducting Philharmonia Aven. Don't get too spooked right now on KPR.